So probably since this is the last day, then if there's any questions or something, then we can move with those. No Uttama Shloka? Yes.
Yesterday we were discussing about the Varnas and Ashrams, four Varnas and four Ashrams. Now, I just was confused about the ashram from Brahmacharya to Grihastha. So how does exactly a person decide whether he must remain a Brahmachari for the whole life or he must become a Grihastha? Because Prabhupada, I have read a statement that Prabhupada says that those who cannot follow Brahmacharya, such people become Grihasthas. So it's like, of course, the senses are always having their own demands and etc. Sensory demands. And so one is supposed to control one's senses. But then that cannot be also unnatural, not one's beyond one's capacity. So then one has to, beyond a certain limit, one has to gratify the senses according to the scriptures, what is minimum required. So where is the fine line where one decides, okay, this much sense control I have done, beyond this not possible, maybe I should change my ashram. This has been a very crucial lesson. How exactly?
So the question is how does one distinguish between whether one can remain as a brahmachari or whether one should get married? You know, how to decide. So Chanakya Pandit basically has a very simple formula that one can follow. That is, if you don't know whether to eat or not to eat, then better don't eat. Because that means one's not actually hungry. One doesn't know whether to travel or not travel, don't travel. Because without the proper determination and fixed mind, then all the different difficulties that will come up in travel will be a disturbance. And if you don't know whether to get married or not get married, then you should get married. Because if you are not supposed to get married, you know that. And if you're not sure, generally is a sign of getting married. Because if you are not going to get married, that you know. But if you don't know whether to get married or not, means generally marriage is the strong option. That's the basic principle. Now when it says that Prabhupada mentions that someone who has difficulty following the Brahmachari ashram, then they can avail themselves to the Grihastha ashram. So this does not mean externally. Externally, then all the Brahmacharis are following very nicely. Right? If one can't follow externally, then there's no question of having to understand. If one can't, has difficulty with menial service, has difficulty with sadhana, has difficulty with accepting authority, has difficulty in studying and these kind of things, has difficulty in maintaining cleanliness, right? A brahmachari means one who can last in brahmachari, he can be clean, right? So if one has difficulty following these, automatically one can understand, then the Grihastha ashram is better, because then one can learn these points. But now if externally one can follow it, that is the first class platform. If we can't follow it, then that's less than first class. But if we can follow all those, then that is first class platform. Now, the difference comes between those who can follow, and internally they're very satisfied. And they can see just continuing doing this. They're happy doing this. Then those who are doing, but they feel that that is going to be difficult to maintain all the time. That they feel something's lacking. They're not able to get their full emotional needs taken care of in that situation. Then for that person, then the marriage is the best option. But it should be after properly finishing one's training. Like that. So it's very simple. It means if you can't follow the externals of brahmacharya, then that's a problem. So marriage is best. Ones who can follow it, then there's two. One who is able to continue with it, and one who can perform the externals of it, but there is still a feeling of some lack.
So basically one has to be satisfied in his ashram.
Yes, basically one must be satisfied. That's one of the major means. These are the things for knowing what to do and what not to do are, one, the scriptures. Right? What the scriptures say. Then, two, is what guru and sadhu says. Right? According to the tradition and everything like that. Then, we have three, then is what we feel satisfied in. Right? So the Veda says what we should do. Then the Shastras, based on the Veda, those scriptures in pursuance of the Vedic version, they also explain. Then we hear from Guru, we hear from Sadhus, then we must be satisfied. Satisfied means we are following, and then, you know, we find that that situation is good. We must always be very careful to understand in the material world there'll never be 100% satisfaction. Right? It's impossible. If we're looking for that, then we're going to be dissatisfied always. Right? But if we can understand that, then that is good. Then we do the best we can. Because it's ultimate point of all the varnas and ashrams is to understand that nothing in the material world is satisfying. Because we've properly performed the duties of the material world, we've reaped the benefits of that, and still we're not satisfied. So then we understand the material world is a place of difficulty. And therefore we take more shelter of the holy name, the devotees, the devotional process, like that.
One small thing. Hmm. Prabhupada says that human life means tapasya. He says a human being must be able to control, he says. So that way, if you see, the process of devotional service, we are taken because we have been in knowledge, etc. We have not developed ruchi in that. Just doing sadhana bhakti. So, though our satisfaction would be to just engage in sense gratification, but then we're controlling it and then.
That's not satisfaction.
So now following a brahmacharya for somebody may be a little difficult. So, can he take a risk that, yes, human life is meant for tapasya, so it must be meant for control. So, can he take the risk and still, in spite of his dissatisfaction, continue with knowledge?
Question is then, for this, Prabhupada makes the point of human life is meant for tapasya. So then, would that mean that someone who is performing the brahmacharya, is in the brahmacharya ashram, is not really satisfied, but he should, you know, grit his teeth and push on because human life is meant for tapasya? You know, so tapasya, you know, because the natural thing is to just enjoy the senses, like that. So, we have to understand that to follow the Vedic system means already tapasya. Because one is following God's rules, right? Because if we follow, even we say, okay, I don't want to follow, I will just follow my senses. In the material world, generally that's what most people are trying to do. But are they able to fulfill all their desires? Right? If they are, why are there so many screwed up people? Right? Means, whatever you want, you can't get as much as what you want of it anyway. Right? So the pasya is actually just following the laws of God. Means what he says for a brahmacharya do, what he says for a grihastha, for a vanaprastha sannyas. Like this. If that's understood, then we understand tapasya means control of the senses. Right? In the Gita, in the list of the austerities of the body, mind, and words. So of the body, it means that there's celibacy. Right, so we described three kinds of brahmacharis. Right, so they're all considered celibate. Then there's cleanliness, that is also an austerity I find that to be, you know, also a very difficult thing for Westerners. They don't like cleanliness, right? You know, it's like they take prasadam in the prasad hall, and because they didn't step in any dal, they ask, why do I have to wash my feet? They can't understand the subtleties of you eat in a place, the floor becomes contaminated. They don't want to wash their feet. They go to the bathroom, they use the magic plastic flip-flops, and after going to the bathroom, you don't have to wash your feet. So that's tapasya, is following the rules and being clean after eating, after using the toilet and all that. So there's tapasya that even the grihastas or even the brahmacharis I've seen in the West aren't willing to follow. That were in place when Prabhupada was here. When Prabhupada was here, it's one of the first things you learn when you move into the temple. How to put on tilak, how to put on the dhoti, how to put on kopans, and how to wash your hands, mouth, and feet after you eat or after you go to the bathroom. Right? I learned that within the first 3 days. I see devotees 15 years, 20 years in the movement, they've never even heard of it. Right? So this is tapasya, cleanliness. Right? You go to the brahmacharya ashram, it looks like, you know, a bomb just hit the place. That's not tapasya. Tapasya is you come into the brahmacharya ashram, it's nice and clean. That's another way you can tell who should get married or not. Look at their things. If they're nice, tidy, clean, their clothes are clean, their bed is clean, then they not really necessary. They may be able to go without getting married. They may be also upakurvana and will get married, first class brahmacharya. But if they can't keep their stuff nice, 100%, you can say they have to get married. Very simple test. This is the test the temple president can take. He just walks into the brahmacharya ashram, he looks around, and then he knows who is or who's not. Very simple.
So how does that compute? One final thing.
How does that compute?
Yeah, why?
Why? Oh, because you can't take care of oneself. It means you have to have a woman to take care. It means you grew up, your mother took care, you threw your socks on the floor, she picked them up, your underwear over here, your dhoti over there. And so then your mother picked it up. You come into the room, it looks nice and clean, but you never stop to think it's because my mother picked it up. So the brahmacharis like that, they come in, throw everything everywhere, so a woman has to pick it up after them. Because human life, you have to be clean. So if you can't be clean yourself, then a woman has to make you clean. So cleanliness, respect of authority. Tapasya is respect of authority. So we find that nowadays, you know, especially email or other things, there's no austerity. Senior devotees, they're not austere. They can't respect authority. The principle has to be accepted. Whoever's in the seat, that's another thing. But the principle, there's two things. There's respect for the person, there's respect for the position. Right? So the position always has to be respected. Right? Like the viceroy comes from the king. Even if the guy's a jerk, you don't respect him, the king will get upset. You can cause a war. Then there's your personal relationship with them. So if it's not so good, you may maintain everything very formal. And, you know, and if it's nice, then it may go more deep. But that's austerity. Respecting authority, respecting the cows, the Brahmins, saintly persons, women, old people. You know, anything has a position of authority. Right? So these are austerities of the body. Not, you know, standing on your head in freezing cold water, you know, or like that. Standing up to your neck in freezing cold sweet rice in the walk-in refrigerator. It's none of these kind of things. Then austerity, the speech. Speak what is pleasant and what is according to Shastra. And not speak to somebody that you shouldn't to in a rough way if it's not your duty to take care. It means the authority can speak strongly because it's their duty to take care. They're giving shelter, so when there's shelter, there must be surrender. So they can speak strongly. Right? And then in the mind that you think, straightforward in dealings, you know, one doesn't contemplate on the sense objects. This is austerity. That's what the Gita gives is austerity. You know? So that goes for all the ashrams. It's not just specifically to the brahmacharya. No, the brahmacharya is learning these things. The grihastha is already mature, knows these things. The grihastha is experienced in following these things. Otherwise, if he's not, how is he going to raise good children? Right? Because for the children, the mother and father are the first gurus. So if they're untrained, their children will be untrained. You know? So austerity is it's not a matter of one's not satisfied as a brahmachari, it's difficulty in that ashram that one remains in that because he thinks that is tapasya. No. Tapasya is engaging the senses in the Lord's service. So for the brahmachari, then he engages in hearing and chanting and seeing the deity and dancing, taking prasad. Right? And he just avoids using the genital in the Lord's service. But if he finds that's difficult, then as a grihastha, then that can be used. Right? So we have to change our concept of what is austerity. It's not that it's something really rough and nasty and that's austerity. No, it's just proper behavior according to the Lord's directions. That is austerity. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, I understand. But let me put it this way.
Maybe do one thing. A specific question gets a specific answer. A general question gets a general answer. So since you've been asking, this is the fourth time asking a question, you still haven't gotten your answer. Because you have a very specific idea, but you're asking a general answer for some reason. Either you're embarrassed or some other way. So that is austerity of the mind, being straightforward.
I've not got any big things in mind. The only thing is that I wanted to say, now I know by knowledge, by reading Shastra and etc., that the best ashram, the most simplest ashram is Brahmacharya ashram. Then I have my past conditioning, I have the knowledge of Brahminical culture. Yesterday you were saying that though we may know by knowledge the Brahminical culture, etc., but then we have our conditioned nature. Now there is always a tug of war between these two. We want to do so many desires are there, according to knowledge, and then we have our past conditioning, which is just pushing of the senses, etc. Mm-hmm. So I want to know exactly how a person decides that where, how much to give in, and how much to accept, and so many things like that. So now I know that the simplest way of life is to remain a brahmachari. I know I'm very impressed with the whole thing and etc. But then I have got the pushing of my senses. So where do I take risk? Okay, let me control, and then how exactly the whole point there. Okay.
So the question keeps coming back, just exactly where is the exact line of the, you know, meterage on means. The point is if it is that difficult where it's constant, then that's already too much. Means someone who can maintain, now and again things come up in the mind. Yamunacharya is saying, right? He's an Uttamadikar, and he says, whenever I think of sex, I spit. Means the mind is a separate entity than us. And mind likes to just move around however it likes. But that doesn't mean that we accept. Like you have a wild kid. Wild kids do anything, say anything. But that doesn't mean that you do it or that you condone it. So the mind may bring up so many things, but then you say no, and then the mind becomes peaceful. So if one finds that most of the time it is peaceful, and especially if there's nothing that will disturb the senses, then it is always peaceful. And then when there is something that may disturb the senses, then generally it's always peaceful. Sometimes it may become disturbed. Then that is within reasonable control. But if all the time the pressure is there in the mind, then that's too much. The line has been crossed. Because it says contemplating enjoying the senses, that is also sense gratification. Like that. So the brahmachari, he's busy. He's absorbed in his menial service, he's absorbed in his study. He's absorbed in following the order of his authorities. So he's busy, he's satisfied. Does that make sense?
Yes. Got the answer.
Okay. Yes.
Maharaj, you were saying that if a brahmachari can't maintain cleanliness, then he should he should get married and then his wife can pick up his things after. But I was just wondering that in today's age, since there isn't so much training or education, what happens if the wife is also untidy and unclean?
Then it's better to just go to the forest. That's what the Chanakya also says that. You know, if the mother-in-law is giving over too much trouble, the wife is untrained like this, you know, like that, the daughter has no respect, this and that, then it's better to leave and go to the forest. It is a I was actually surprised when I went out the last year. I was going through some of the countries, and the girls don't know how to clean the rooms, and you know, you'll have something on the table and they'll clean the table and put it back crooked, and I was actually very surprised. So then one should very seriously consider either learn how to clean up oneself or learn to tolerate. But I guess you could look at it this way, is if you can't take care of yourself anyway, you won't really notice if the wife doesn't do such a good job either. You know, you could look at it like that. The point is that one should learn how to take care like that, because a good brahmachari can take care of himself. So it's only the emotional support that is being looked for. But if one is so physically dependent, then it'll be very hard to leave later. Because what you'll fall back on? If you're a brahmachari, you can take care of yourself, but there is still some attachment for certain kinds of emotional support. Then, after going through the grihastha ashram, when one you know, winds up those desires, then one can fall back on that earlier brahmachari training and then be independent. But if one is not able to be independent as a brahmachari, it will be difficult later. That's why Prabhupada says, first-class brahmachari, I'll make a first-class grihastha. One, he'll do the grihastha ashram nicely. Two, he'll be able to leave nicely. And after leaving, he'll be able to maintain. Well, if one's not as trained, grihastha life will be a little more difficult, and it will be more difficult to leave it. So it's always good that we develop these qualities, but if not, then... Otherwise, if one is expert, the wife's not, then one has to train the wife. Like that. So one should marry someone who can be trained. Who knows that? You had it. Then we get to you.
I have a question. There is a lot of talk about ISKCON reform.
ISKCON reform.
Yeah, and reforming the society. Mm. So, is there anything like this, like in a Vedic society, that something is going on that's wrong, and who is observing it and who is correcting the situation? I'm just trying to know, as opposed to the modern way of doing things, observing something, getting together, and I don't know, pointing out and then making law and then reinforcing the law. So if there is something similar or different in a Vedic way.
Mm. The question is there some system in the Vedic society of reform, of how to reform the society, how to see that the proper standards are being maintained? So the Vedic culture is actually based on reform. Modern culture is not. Modern culture only gets too weird, then they start talking about reform. But reform is not built into the Western model. Like that. It only comes when there's a problem. Then they think about reform. Right? It's just like this. You have, to be an example, let's say you have a car. Someone who knows cars nicely is always repairing the car. They're always checking it, putting in their oil, checking the brakes, fixing this, that, a little bit of, you know, just regular. Even if it's not completely finished, they'll change the air filter, the oil filter, like this. And you'll see, generally, they never have any problems with their cars. Another system, someone who doesn't know about cars, when the thing falls apart, then only they consider fixing it. And then they wonder why it's so much, and it's such a big thing, and it's such a big headache, instead of just constantly doing little things. So this is what I mean by the Western culture reform is not built in. Only when something goes wrong, majorly, and then it is considered. But the Vedic culture is based on reform. That's what the Prabhupada says, reformatory process of the Brahman, reformatory process. That's what samskaras are. So the Vedic system, you start off, the child is conceived through reform. It means the mentalities of the parents are reformed, and the place where the child will be placed is put through a reformatory process. Right? So the womb is reformed. Then there's another samskar after a month, after conception. Then when the child becomes conscious. Then just before childbirth. Then at birth. Then the name-giving ceremony after, 10, 12 days. Then after that, a ceremony after 3 months for their health. Then after that, anaprasana for their digestive, proper. Then after that, then the cleanliness, they shave their head. Then they're reformed for study, right? They go through, they learn how to write. Like you see Prabhupada holding Dwarkadisha's hand, and he's showing him how to write. That's called Vidyaramba. Like this. And then you have marriage. Then you have initiation. Then there's the death ceremony. So the whole life is reform. The Vedic culture is based on this. And then, as we mentioned, is that the first thing is every individual must learn to reform themselves. If they can't, they wouldn't be allowed to stay in the Vedic society. You'd have to go out to the forest. Means it's very easy that I see something. I'm observant, right? I see something and then I have to send out an email message to, 50 people. But, charity begins at home. It means those who can reform themselves, they're the ones that can work towards reforming others. Right? Someone who can't reform himself, he can bring up his point to someone who can reform himself and then let them take care. Right? This is honest. Because if you can't do it for yourself, then one should be honest enough to know that he should just, leave other people alone. So first you start off with who can reform themselves. Then from those who can reform themselves, then you look for those people who can understand the whole system. How they can work with others. What are the different situations for everybody. How to decide who's in what varna and ashram. What are the duties of those varnas and ashrams? What is the method of maintaining that discipline? Then those persons are chosen to see that the society maintains its position of purity. And then you have a group who know very deeply the theology of this, and then they see that those who can practically do it are working according to the shastras. Right? And those who are doing it see that the Brahmins are doing their work, the Kshatriyas their work, Vaishyas their work, Shudras their work. And then the Brahmins see that the Kshatriyas are doing their work. So that's the Vedic system, is that it's constantly from the beginning going on. Right? That's the whole concept of education even, is that it's reformation. And the modern is you just get some academic knowledge. Why? So that you can get a job. Why? So you can get money. Why? So you can enjoy your senses. So there's no reformatory aspect built into it at all. The Vedic system is in the home, you're not going to reform yourself. Because you're being taken care of and you just get conditioned to that. So you're taken out of the home environment and put with the teacher. And the teacher then trains you to be observant to actually yourself and the world around you. In other words, the teacher puts you in touch with yourself and nature and God. Then, after that training, now you're fit to go back into the society and actually do something in the society, be a follower, a leader, or both. So the education is built on reform, the leadership is built on reform, the individual family life is built on reform, and the individual himself must always be looking at his own position. And that's easy because you have a standard. Krishna has given rules. You just see, am I following the standard? Right? There. One is supposed to, human life is meant for austerity. So am I clean? Am I respectful? Like that. Am I celibate? Right? Am I speaking according to Shastra or just according to my emotions? You know, am I speaking nicely, or am I just using the modern system to just cut the other person to shred, and that gets it off your chest, and everything is wonderful. You know, like this. So, what system I am using? So the Vedic, you had a system, you had a standard, and then you just could compare to that. Right? The rules don't change every few you know years. Like that. Means now in the modern culture, what is standard? Before, you go back some years back, not following authority was like the strangest thing. Now if you follow authority, then you must be weird. Anyone who can speak out against authority, they're considered very mature and observant and honest. You know? But if you consider, well, maybe the leader also is an individual, then you're conformist, you're so many, you know, things. Oh, you support them. There's no middle path. See, the Vedic system, you have from 0 to 100. In the modern system, you have 0 and you have 100. There's nothing in between. Right? You're for or you're against. That's it. But in the Vedic culture, there's shades in between. Someone's a Brahmin. They're not such a good Brahmin. But they're able to perform some basic principles. So they're respected that much. Modern, unless you're an avatar, you're thrown out the window. You know, it's all or nothing. There's nothing in between. Like that. So one has to be very, very careful that one is able to see, because that's called discrimination. See, why does this come up? One may ask, why in the modern culture you have this, you know, all or nothing, and in the Vedic culture you had a spectrum. That's because the intelligence works on spectrum. It discriminates. Okay, this is this much, this is this much, this is this much, like that. So that's called intelligence. So the Vedic culture is based on intelligence. The mind, it accepts or rejects. It only has two options. You know, it's like it's binary, you know. It's either a one or a zero. That's it. There's no other option. So the modern culture is based on the mind. The mind, the senses, you know, the sub-emotions, not even the real emotions. Like this. So these are, therefore it gives rise to the culture the way it is. So it's not the best culture. It doesn't have reform in mind. The mind doesn't think about reform. Right? The intelligence discriminates. Mind thinks about reform. It means that if it clicks over to, you know, it doesn't like, then it's time for reform. If it's on the side I like, no one's talking reform. Right. But in the Vedic cultures, that one can see in between and discriminate how much, how little, like that. So that's based on intelligence. You know? Like that. And then intelligence connects to the scriptures, or the mind connects to the senses. I like my senses like it, my feelings like it, then it's good. They don't like it, it's not good. Like now, before, you go back like 10 years, someone had to say, Prabhupada says, or Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. Then devotees would go, okay, here's something solid. Nowadays, you can just say, I feel. And that is like 100% evidence. You know? That's all. It just takes, I feel. So that's the mind. We've dropped from the intelligence to the platform of the mind. And then from the platform of the mind, next is the platform of the senses. Like that. So right now we're in the transitory stage. Transitory stage is where there's mind and senses mixed, so we worry about everybody else. I'm worried about my position, so then instead of just standing on my own, then I whip up a big thing that, well, everybody else also. You know, I'm having problem in the temple, so therefore I have to get everybody into it that they all feel, and then we can say yes. This is issues. This is called what in Sanskrit they call pranamoy, extended sense gratification. I worry about others' sense gratification, like that. So this is generally the top platform that the Western culture gets to. It never actually gets means we mentioned that you have the platform of religious principles, which is the platform of the mind. But Ramanujacharya mentions that actually until you get to the actual directions of God, you never actually get to that platform. You know? Like that. So the pure experience of the mind's emotions without the senses generally nowadays is not experienced. You know, it's just like the mind can experience, let's say, motherly or fatherly affection without any contact with the kid. Right? Nowadays, it's only when there's talk, when you're touching the kid or doing something with the kid, then you feel, yes, something is there. But on the higher platform, it doesn't require that. You know? You know, mother can see the child's shoes and remember the child. You know? Like that. And that experience, the emotions being felt. So it's actually the modern culture is cheating itself. They think they're really moving towards the individual and tasting and experiencing, but they're not. Because when you leave Krishna's direction, it is Krishna's creation. And unless you follow the manual, the creation is not going to work for us as we like. As soon as we separate ourselves, then we are going to do how we like. Then it's not going to react. We think we're getting. So even within the illusion, we're being illusioned. Right? Means the reflection of the spiritual realm. There's the pure reflection. It's perverted, but it's still seeming closer to the normal. Then there's the perversion of that when you give up following the Lord's directions. That. So that's what's being experienced now. Anytime you have a movement, anytime you have, and at the core of that's an issue, even though it feels like something's really happening, it's still on platform Pranamoy. It's sub-religious. It's not actually on the platform of Dharma. Does that make sense? Yeah. Another question?
Krishna says, Bandura Manastasya, that the mind will become a friend, you know, once it's regulated. But it feels as though it had a will, and that the only way to control it is by strengthening the intelligence. So I'm just wondering, is it possible in this age for the mind to actually, you know what I mean, to
become a friend?
Yeah, to be fully purified. You know, or is it more that we should be satisfied with a strengthened intelligence?
So the question is in this age, then can the mind be purified, where it becomes a friend, like Krishna mentions in the Gita? And, you know, can that be done, or is it only a matter of we strengthen the intelligence and be satisfied with that? No, in the process of devotional service, in the middle stages of the Madhyam development, the mind starts to become the friend. Because once it has a taste for devotional service, then that's when it starts to become friendly. Right? Means when it has a taste for Maya, that's when it's our enemy. When it has a taste for Krishna, that's when it's our friend. So to that degree that it has a taste for Krishna consciousness, then to that degree it's our friend. Like that. So by performance of the devotional practices, by associating with devotees, advanced devotees, hearing from them and performing our devotional activities, then we become purified. Right? The mind becomes purified. And then we gain a taste for devotional service. Right? So this means that by associating with those who are advanced, then we start to develop their interests, right? Their methodology, their mood, like this. So then we also make a commitment that we aren't interested in the senses. Then we find in the mind switches what it will be attached to. The mind has to be attached to something. It's just the nature of the mind. So if you attach it to Krishna, then it's nice. The mind itself is not the problem. The problem is our desires. So So if we can change the desires, then the mind goes to mind is attracted by Krishna, then it's not a problem at all. Whatever you see reminds you of Krishna. So like that. But the process of devotional service is you strengthen the intelligence. So with knowledge, then you are performing your activity. You know? Then you are performing your activity. Because in knowledge you do something, then there's less attachment. The mind thinks it's doing everything. Because it desires, it thinks it's doing. So as soon as we control it by the intelligence, then that problem is solved. It means it starts to not go towards the senses and becomes attracted to Maya. So you have to have both. Detachment from Maya, attachment to Krishna. So you have to follow the rules and regulations to detach ourselves from Maya, and we have to follow those processes that help us develop attachment for Krishna. Does that make sense? Yes.
Sannyasi and ex-Brahmachari, I guess you must have had intimate realizations which protected you from being unchaste throughout your ashram. And so would you like to share these realizations with us so that we may be inspired to... Like, I guess it could be like maybe summarized into a short list of the four steps that helps one to remain chaste with a chaste vision, with like of a real position as spiritual or different things.
Tried. Yeah, basically. But whether.
Because as Prabhu was saying, the mind may pull us.
Uh-huh.
But if one somehow more sincerely wishes to remain Brahmachari, maybe he can manage to tame his mind in some way.
Mataji is asking then what are the, you know, what have we found that has been useful in for maintaining the Brahmacharya ashram? Mm-hmm. Like this. Is that first how do I say? Well, the thing comes to mind, we'll just talk what comes to mind, is that of always keeping oneself engaged. You know, Prabhupada quotes that term, how do you call it? An idle mind is a devil's workshop. So if one's always engaged, then generally the mind is peaceful. So that engagement must come according to authority. So in the Vedic culture, everyone always tries to put themselves under authority. Everybody has an authority. Even the acharya, he always follows his acharya. So there's always the following of authority. Then one is able to, yeah, then the mind is always peaceful. One is always busy. Then to follow authority means there must be respect for authority. So one must have the understanding why we follow authority, that Krishna is the ultimate authority. And then that whole system of representing Krishna, then it is coming down through so many persons. So that comes down through knowledge, through age, through wealth, through fame, through power, or through renunciation. So then anywhere where that is, that must be respected. Then that will create humility. And then humility, then one can engage in so many activities, so many services. If there's no humility, then it is very difficult to maintain the concept of Brahmacharya. Because humility means we're not the enjoyer. Like that. So if we're not the enjoyer, then that means we're supposed to, you know, follow a prescribed path. If we're proud, then naturally there is, the point comes up of then if we're proud, then we must be some variety of controller, right? We're expert at something. And then from that expertise of that naturally comes then the rewards, which is the enjoyer. Right? These are the two things that keep us in the material world. I think I'm the controller. I think I'm the enjoyer. You remove these two concepts, you remove basically the material vision. The material world is based on I think I'm the controller and I'm the enjoyer. So if you can remove those, one is not actually in the material world. So that is very important. Then one should avoid, you know, talking all kinds of nonsense. One should associate with those who are more advanced. One should not associate with those who you shouldn't. And, you know, as Prabhupada mentions, you know, men and women shouldn't unnecessarily talk unless there's some actual service, some actual practical work. He mentioned the brahmachari talks to the women as much to say, pass the salt. In other words, it's just some practical work, that's it. Okay. So those are, you know, that would be there. Having faith in the devotional process, having faith in Srila Prabhupada, his position, having faith that he actually knows what he's talking about, you know. Prabhupada is the, you know, self-effulgent acharya. He knows what he's talking about. He knows what he did. Someone mentioned to me, I think mid-70s, Prabhupada mentioned to one of them, says, if I had it to do all over again, means coming to the West, establishing ISKCON, said I wouldn't have done anything different. As I did it, I would have done it again. So, this is the principle. The spiritual masters, you know, there's a rope on the ground. Spiritual master says it's a snake, then the disciple thinks, well, actually it's due to my imperfect senses. I'm considering that it's a snake, a rope, so I don't actually know the dangers at hand. Then one says it's a snake. The spiritual master says, no, it's a rope. Then one says, my senses are imperfect. I was thinking it's a snake, it's a rope. So in other words, when it comes to the spiritual subject matter, how the spiritual controls matter, because that's what's going on. Matter does not control matter. Our body is not controlling anything. Our subtle body is not controlling anything. The material nature, having empowered by the Lord, is moving everything. So whatever we see that we've done and we consider we've done and we do, we haven't done any of it. The modes of nature have done all of it. Krishna, to the point of blinking our eyes or evacuating. You know? Even that is being done by the modes. We're not even doing that. So it doesn't leave a whole lot for us. You know? Or then our most popular one is even, Krishna says, influencing people. We think, yeah, I went, talked, and worked all this out and got all this happening. And says that also we didn't do. The modes of nature did. We desired to do it. Krishna sanctioned it, modes of nature do it for us. So one has to understand is that spirit is actually controlling the matter. So there's nothing that we're doing. And, you know, Srila Prabhupada, understanding these principles and coming from the spiritual realm, he knows what he's doing. Right? Right now, in a very liberal society, you know, in its ways, so many, you can do practically anything, dress any way you like. I mean, people nowadays walk down the street with a bald head, you know, they even have sikhas. You know, it means that the last, I think, Academy and Grammy Awards, three Karmi ladies, not devotees, wore saris to pick up their awards. Right? Like that. So, in a society that's in this way very liberal, the devotees themselves think, oh, Prabhupada, many devotees are thinking, well, not even many, some devotees are thinking, Prabhupada didn't really know the situation, how to apply it in the modern world. Why? Because we don't have the faith that we can go out into the public as devotees, present our culture as it is, and have it respected. And now, in such a liberal state, we're thinking, oh, it's so wrong. Well, Prabhupada came, you know, what now? Over 30 years ago, into a culture that was so conservative, right? So conservative, and implanted the Vedic culture very nicely. People were following it, and people were respecting it, right? Because we see just, they read the other day that both Germany and Russia, then they checked what we have, they checked their philosophy, and they said, this is bona fide religion. So even the Karmis say, this is bona fide. So it's just, you know, uninformed Karmis, and they may say, you know, this and that, and uninformed devotees may think this and that. But factually we see that Prabhupada knew what he was doing. So we have faith in that. That also is very, one, it's the strength of our devotional advancement, and two, then it's also very easy to maintain chastity. If we can't be chaste to our acharya, there's no question of being materially chaste. Right? Means chastity is just a practice for ultimate spiritual chastity. Right? If we can't be chaste to our acharya, then there's no real greatness to anything else, other chastity. It won't be there. Right? Especially for a Westerner. Maybe an Indian. They've come from very grown up like this, can't understand why Krishna dances with all these girls, he should just stick to one woman. And like that, but they themselves be materially very chaste. Right? But as a living entity, whose business is serving Krishna as Prakriti, and he is the Purusha, that is a sign of unchastity. So chastity is tested first with the devotees and the guru, the acharya. Then from there, then we can say, I'm very fixed in service to Krishna. They're all connected. Like that. So when that is understood, then, right? Does that make sense? Is that okay? Yes. Can one live at home, do business? Oh, claim to be a brahmachari and wear saffron. It definitely would not be traditional. One can, generally, business starts when one becomes a grihastha, generally. Though you do see in the business communities, they'll be doing business and helping and then setting up and learning. And they might set one up before marriage, but then that would be upakurvana. And upakurvanas never wear saffron. Like that. You know, at least once they leave the ashram, they don't. That they wear white. Means in the ashram they have their matted locks and they wear their deer skin and all that. When they leave the ashram, then they give that up. They put on nice clothes, nice dhotis and all this and that, and shave their head and, you know, then let it grow nicely and keep it combed and all. So the upakurvana, once he's finished his studies, then, at that time, then they may get involved in these things. But they don't wear saffron. You know? I mean, what's the purpose? Right? One is respecting detachment. That is the point. Otherwise, grihasthas also are not having that, you know, that much sex. Right? They have two kids, then they may have had sex twice. Maybe a few more if there's a few misses. You know? So what's the big deal? Why is he so special? He wears saffron. Does that make sense? Yeah. So they shouldn't wear saffron. They can still say they're brahmachari, but that means upakurvana, which means, or snataka, which means unmarried. In the Vedic system, the snataka means one who's graduated, but then he has not gotten married yet. What about brahmacharis engaged in management? It depends upon what the management is. because in the temples for the deities, for the preaching, that's all brahminical management, and that can many times be managed by the Brahmins. It's not managed by, you know, you don't have a kshatriya to manage the deity department. It's just, you don't have it. Brahmins who have managerial abilities, they do it. Like that, you know, or the preaching, that also generally can be managed by Brahmins. So that can be done by brahmacharis. That's not a problem. Like that. Generally, it's where you have big, you know, overall things, then, unless that is their nature, then it's better to avoid. But otherwise, it depends. Because a Brahmin can manage, you see, is that the kingdom, the ministers are Brahmins. And many times when the king is out, they do the management. So depending upon the nature of it and the size of it and what they have to deal with, then generally you'll see that they're married. You know? But otherwise, it's not a problem in doing, it depends upon the degree of what they have to deal with. It's very much individual. And depends upon their abilities. You know? Does that make any sense? Or, yeah. Yes.
I'm interested in the process of yagya, making sacrifice. I've heard an atheistic argument that if the yagya works, it means if these personalities are accepting the fruit, the benefit of the yagya, then one can just go on a trip and somebody can make a yagya and he'll be fed. So I wouldn't know how to answer this argument. Actually, I do not understand how do these personalities really accept the offerings, like the demigods or even the pitris who are not superhuman and to whom we're offering Sudanta. How can they accept if the offering drink the water?
Question is on yagyas, on how they're accepted by the persons they're offered it to. Means is Agni, he takes the offering and gives it to whoever it's being meant for. So when we offer something into the fire, then that is being accepted. He delivers it to whoever. It's known as Jatavedas. And in Jatavedas, there's a prayer that one says in asking that he carries this to whatever the personality is that it's being offered to. Like that. So that's what's going on. You know. So the point is someone may say, well, and then the example is given, well, you can do your, if the yagya is actually giving the fruit, then you would be able to go somewhere, you know, and then just do a yagya and get the result. You know, it's the same as work. You do your work, you get your result. If you go somewhere and you know, pick beans or something, then you get a result. But there's more than just this. This is the Vedic application. The main, what everything is referred to, is the fire sacrifice. But we find in this age, the main yagya is the Harinam Sankirtan. Right? So Agni, he has, I think, the seven tongues. Right? So in the Samphikan Yagya, those seven tongues are Cheto Darpana Marjanam, Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam, Shreya Kaira Vichandrika Vicharanam, Vidya Vadhu Jivanam, Anandam Buri Vardhanam, Pratipanam Purnam Rikaswaranam, Sarvatma Snapanam. Those are the seven tongues of the Samphikan Yagya. So if if the Samphikan is being performed, then the result is there. The main point is if someone thinks I am doing it because I did something, I'm getting a result. That is the difficulty. But if they understand it's not coming because of that, then there's less illusion. Yes.
Okay. So did you see that now making a resolution that preferably some rashis and dhammacharis should not be managed?
Mm-hmm. saying is the GBC is making, you know, moving in the direction of resolutions that brahmachari sannyasis shouldn't manage. Like that, then that grihastha should manage. So we've mentioned that brahmacharis. It depends on what they're managing. There's something like deities and preaching, that is very natural for them to do. Like that. But, you know, temples or especially communities generally wouldn't be done so much. But the point is that just by switching it from the brahmachari sannyasis, which there's very few, right? This is what you call, what is it? Tempest in a teapot. You know, is how many sannyasis are actually running temples or running these things, right? It's like that. We have like maybe 85 gurus. How many of them have cut a big, big profile, have lots of money, fly around? How many? Handful? Count them on one hand. Right? How many temples out of our 350 are managed by sannyasis and brahmacharis? Right? If you go back in history, Prabhupada's time, most all the temples are run by grihasthas. It was understood that if you run a temple, you have to deal with the ladies, so it's better to be a grihastha. So all through the 70s, early 80s, from what I remember, all that was mainly grihasthas running the temples. But all the past evils of temple life and management is being blamed on the brahmacharis and sannyasis, even though it's all been done by grihasthas. So it's a modern concept of scapegoat. The GBC are only addressing this because it seems that a general mass of devotees who have modems, then they are not very happy with this. Like that. So the point is that one has to first understand what management is, one has to understand. Because even you take them out, fine. There's a saying in English, there's plenty of room at the top. Right? I know so many of the sannyasis, but they don't want to manage. They've been saying it for years. But, you know, we're still waiting for those self-effulgent grihasthas to step forward and manage it. So the point is just changing is not the thing. There's training. It means whoever is in the position has to be qualified. That's the thing. Right? Is it just automatic as soon as you change your cloth from saffron to white, you suddenly become an expert manager, an expert parent, you know, a community advisor, you know, I mean, all these things, it's something mystic or something? It's the power of the bleach. It must be the chemical in the bleach. By smelling it, then that just opens up the managerial and parental chakras, you know, and then one is able to. Or maybe it's the bluing. Maybe the bluing, like that. You know, bluing. I don't know if you use it. You use it in the West? Use it? Huh? No one uses it anymore. Oh. Not used anymore. All right. Just let them wear gray cloth nowadays. Okay. Okay. We want two. It's too old-fashioned for this one. So, you know, in other words, the training has to be there. The GBC are only addressing this because it's felt very strongly around the society that the whole problem is. Like Alachua is falling apart, right? Because it's being managed by sannyasis and brahmacharis. Right? LA has been a mess for years because it's always been managed by brahmacharis and sannyasis. Right? Temple president in the manor has always been a brahmachari or sannyasi, right? You know, you go to Govardhan, it's always been a brahmachari or sannyasi. Right? Any culture or society where there's a lot of grihasthas and there's lots of problems and a big mess is because brahmacharis and sannyasis have been the ones doing the hand-on management, isn't it? Huh? Of course, yes. So, that's the point. But to satisfy the mind, you have to find somebody to get. And when you find that, then everybody can get together, and then they can feel a sense of community. As we mentioned before, is if you have a bunch of people who can't work together, then you create a common enemy or a common issue, then they can all work together as long as that enemy or issue is present. Example that struck me strongest was Afghanistan. Afghanistan, historically, is a country of warring tribes, you know? And they just fight with each other like cats and dogs. So then, you know, it's been always unmanaged and, you know, no strong government. So the Russians thought, well, here's a nice opportunity. We'll just come in and take over this, you know, unorganized place. So then they came in, and then all of these madhouse tribals got together, and then they fought against the Russians. And then finally, after a long, long time, they got rid of the Russians. As soon as the Russians pulled out, again they just started fighting with each other. Like that. So that's history. So it creates on the Pranamoy platform, it creates unity when you create a common cause of justice, right? Economics, morality. These are all the platform of Pranamoy, right? So you create that, then you can bring people together. Otherwise, you know, what is the platform?
My enemy's enemy is my friend.
Yeah, your enemy's enemy is your friend. So, like that, you deal on that platform. So the whole Vedic concept is we come together because there's a common standard of God's culture. And we learn how to behave within that culture and how to work within that culture. Then it works very nicely. Right? Works very nicely. Like that. This way. How do we become familiar? Okay. A very nice point. How do we guard against becoming familiar with those that we work with? So, basically one has to understand the rarity of devotees and devotional service. How rare it is. I mean, we see Sanatana Goswami's teachings and also the prayers of the residents, I think, of Jambudvip in the fifth canto. Then they start off that there's unlimited living entities in the universe. Then out of these unlimited living entities, then a few of them, or it says very few, are human. Right? Then of those few that are human, only a few of them are civilized. I mean, civilized means they follow the Vedic culture. Then of those few that are civilized, only a few actually have an interest in liberation. And of those, or know about it, have an interest. Of those few that have an understanding or an interest, only a few of those endeavor for it. And of those few that endeavor for it, actually only a few get it. And of those few, only a few actually come to the platform of devotional service. So then, that then, if we understand that, then we understand devotional service and those who come to it are very rare. Like that. Very rare. So, if with that appreciation, then if we're humble, then we always appreciate the devotees. We're always deal nicely with them, respectful to them. Means we used to have, you know, it was there in, I guess, earlier ISKCON, is that in the temple, everyone would offer their obeisances to each other in the morning, whenever they'd see. Because that would be everybody. So, you know, practices like that would maintain the enthusiasm, the rarity, understanding that. Then things become nicer. That's an important. Is that? That's the basic principle. Oh, it's question is that someone a established culture based on the Seven Habits book, and some are disturbed by this. Means what's being written about here basically is your some of your fundamental principles of just organization, how to manage. And the main thrust of it is for those who are going to especially run businesses and things like that, though it does relate to the family. Now, the basic principles are there, and principles, they work. Principles, whatever the situation. Now, there's two ways one can get to these principles. One is by accepting the authority of the Shastra and seeing the, how you say, seeing the example of the authorities and how those who have gone before us, how they have applied themselves. And then to those who are contemporaries who follow those examples very nicely based on the Shastra. Then one can gain those same principles. Another way is just observing the material world. You observe for a long time. If you're intelligent, the Lord allows, then you can see some of the framework, how the material world works. Like that. But there'll be a difference in the result of the two. Because when we learn by authority, coming down through the Vedic culture, then we gain that culture, that mood, that flavor. And if we don't, if we just do it by observing, if we're not basing that observation on something from the Shastra, then we will develop something that we see. Now, the point is you have to apply that through some medium, right? You have a principle of management, but there are values that it has to go through to be applied. So now, what are the values going to be? Right? In that book, then the highest the values can get are sub-religious or pranamoya. And generally, that's only that high. Most management books are not even dealing the upper ends of pranamoya, they're dealing the lower ends, or just anamoya, because they're pure just business management. But here, because of the person's, Christian background, he tries to throw in some morality along with it, and just being a nice guy. So then, that little bit will come. But Krishna's recommending that one works one's activities and the values through the platform of manamoy, which is given in the Vedic scriptures as the religious principles and how you organize the society. And only with the highest principles of, vijnana and ultimately anandamoy, or love for God. So you can perform those practical management duties of the platform of pranamoya, but with the understanding of manamoya, vijnanamoya, and anandamoya. Then you get that culture coming down from the spiritual realm. But otherwise, if you take it as it is, you'll only get the culture at best, of that level of pranamoya. So it will have a weakness. So it's got practical elements. So those who are very practical appreciate it. But those who are a little worried about the subtleties of application, they get worried because there's no substance in that side. There may be substance in the, how you say, just mechanical principles of management. But as far as culture goes, the substance is very weak. One may come, morality, caring for others, devotees don't care for others. But it's very interesting how in the modern concept of caring for others, it's like, what is it called? I think the term is called emotional fascism. Is that for my emotions, then the person who opposes that, we can completely obliterate them. Right? But the whole concept was, is the leader doesn't care. But we will deal with the leader according to the same principles. We don't care for the leader. Rather than the leader's not caring, he should deal in a caring way. We deal in a caring way to try to get him to understand how to care for others. Right? So in other words, it just switches it from ourselves, I mean, the problem from ourselves to the other person. And it focuses the attention from other people to ourselves. That's all that's happened. So it's what a book I read when I was a kid calls Newspeak. It's just you change the words, right? Someone is not mentally retarded. He's intellectually challenged. You know how you say someone who's not very who's short is chronologically deficient. You know, or someone who's very tall is chronologically enhanced. You know? So, like that, it says the same thing, but because of the words, we think we're being so kind and nice and everything like this. But those people who don't deal like that, we're very vicious with. So it has no substance to it. It's a very, very dangerous thing. It's just the way the modern culture works. But unfortunately, we should be very careful to stick to our own culture. Because that has depth. It has tradition. The modern, what's there today, you come back in another year, changes. Like that. So the principles is like this. Someone who knows management will look at it, see the principles, immediately just be able to apply it. The person who has to really study it and practice it and this and that, they're not a manager. And they can use those things and still never get anywhere. Because, the people who know how to manage are already managing. And if you point out a few details, means it says, seven habits of these great personalities. Did these great personalities read a book called Seven Habits? No. So that's the point. The Varnashram point is those who know how to manage already are doing it. Those who know how to do business are already doing it. Right? Someone who's a good businessman who's living outside the temple, they're already doing business. They're already making money. They're not sitting around saying that there's no money. Like that. So that's the point is that someone who is good, they'll read it through and catch a few things and then they can apply it with no problem. But someone who has to read it, study it, and when they apply it, you feel, okay, here comes Puppy Pod walking down the hall. They're not managers and they don't know how to apply it. See, it's like this. A good manager will work it out himself, maybe over time, and if you can teach him some techniques, he works it out quicker. But if you don't, he'll work it out himself. Those who are not observant, then they have to be taught this. And once learning it, still doesn't mean they apply it. I don't know if I brought it up here, or just in connection with this. There was a devotee in one of our temples, temple president of one of our major temples, and he would maintain himself by giving lectures, training people in the philosophy of Kavi. How to manage. So he was one of their authorized teachers. He taught for the Kavi Institute. And he was the temple president of this temple. But after some time, the devotees got so tired of his bad management and bad dealings and bad behavior, he felt impelled to leave. So now he full-time just teaches, teachers how to teach, Kaviism. So he may know the book very nicely, frontwards and backwards, but still he can't manage. he can give a great class on it. Right? So he may be a good teacher, but he's not a good manager. So the book doesn't make one a manager. A manager is a manager. No, that's the Vedic system. So one should be careful. It means for those who are managers, they can maybe gain something from it. You know? Or some of their practical points. But otherwise, those same points are there in the Bhagavatam. But they're presented through the cultural medium. So they may be harder to pick out. Right? Like you take, like one of his points is that you should be nice to the people you work with. You know, how you say, sensitive to, you know, those around you, the family members and other place people at the workstation, like that, right? So now, if we look in the Bhagavatam, when Prithu Maharaj is made the king, then when he's coming into the palace, then it mentions in the verse, as he was entering the palace, he's entering, you know, going on the procession, he's reciprocating with everybody who's approaching him according to their position. It didn't say some people or occasionally. It said everybody. So you can imagine there's a lot of people out there, but he is able to just notice everybody for a moment and reciprocate with them. So is that not the same principle? But now this is applied. He just says be sensitive. But he doesn't bring in the thing of those above us, equal to us, junior to us. You know? So here's the culture. Here's a leader. And here is what he's doing. So we may say, well, we've tried the Vedic culture, it doesn't work, we have to go to Kavi. Who has tried this point? Which manager will say that this is the point of reciprocating with others? Right? So that's the Veda, that's what the Bhagavatam says. That's the Vedic system. Like that. So we have to be, we need to actually look into our own heritage and see that our own heritage is something very special. Like that. Then it makes sense. We don't need to worry about these things so much. Yeah? Means I have no problem if someone who knows management reads this and picks out a few things and then notices them in the Bhagavatam and then applies it through that medium. Yes, ma'am.
It seems that the communication is some kind of difficulties, like you said, now that the king can see each citizen clearly, he can relate to each one because of the subtlety the king possesses. If now in our, some of our temples, if this, you know, ability is not developed yet fully, then will this, is the ghost here kind of program? I hope that the GPC were suggesting that what would you suggest how we can develop that ability?
Oh, I see. The Mataji's question is that GBC has brought up the point of istaghosti, and now will that be useful in establishing these kind of fine points that we find in the Vedic culture? The process of devotional service and purification development is based on hearing and association. So if istaghosti is used as istaghosti rather than as managerial form. See, originally istaghosti meant devotees got together, you read some scripture, like it was very popular, you know, in the early 70s, like that, Nectar of Devotion. You'd read some points, some discussions would be on that. Devotees would ask questions. It would go. In other words, one would try to understand what is Rupa Goswami saying in Nectar Devotion. And devotees with some realization would make points. Others would ask questions. It would be a very free, open forum. So by this process, then one can develop those finitudes. That is one of the main, by study, by discussion, by association, by observing, by seeing example, like that. But if we only use it as Tagosti simply means the temple president wants to get everybody fired up for something or like that, and some managerial thing, then it'll work for that purpose, but it won't work for the purpose of actually cultivating, you know, that refining our understanding. Does that make sense? This Tagosti is the main. When we say sadhu sangha, it actually that means when devotees come together and discuss. You know, that's called this Tagosti. You know, sadhu sangha just means, you know, there's not really any so much of a form to it. Come together a little bit, this and that. When there's some form. You know, like you take the Bhagavatam or that, and it's discussing. In other words, what nowadays you call a workshop. That's more istagosti. So that's the system. That's the Vedic system. You learn.
Is there said that we need that more in our temples to discuss, you know, the basic, the philosophy, the personalities in Bhagavatam, that we find.
Yeah.
See their examples.
Yeah, no, that's very, it's, by Mataji's point is that the best thing to do, to try to, by hearing the example, everything. It's very interesting, is one major, I was just hearing yesterday, is one big teacher in Boston, a big professor in education in Boston. Then he made one point in education, is that stories are very important. Then they should be stories about people who have qualities, good qualities that you want the children to learn. So by everyone hearing good qualities and that. That's why the Vedics, why is India, at least up to just recently, the last few years, stays together as one culture that goes back thousands of years, because the same stories are always told, Mahabharata, Ramayana, these Vedic histories. So the children have the same role models, the same, you know, heroes and examples of what is proper behavior, what is not proper behavior. Therefore, that's come through. Now, the last few years, then we have this new thing coming in, which is the foreign television. So they have these, you know, satellite dishes, and they can get all the shows from America, this and that. So many of you may have noticed that just within the last, basically, you know, 3 years, that half of India wears blue jeans now. So that is all because of this, because they've changed their stories, what they hear about. Right? So because of that, then there's a change in the values of India. So what you want people to learn, they should hear those stories, discuss those stories, discuss those examples. Then one will gain those qualities. So istagosti is a very important element. I know in the Chopati Temple in Bombay is that their new bhakti program lasts 2 years. So they have their regular morning class, evening class, and then in the day, then they have, I think it's an hour and a half or 2 hours, they have every day is the Gosti. And they take a book like that, Nectar Devotion or something, and they read a little bit and discuss it. And then the next day they come back, and if there's more discussion, they continue it, or they go on to the next point. So it's just very informal. They just go through and discuss it, you know, until there's no more points to be made and no one has any more questions. And they do this for 2 years. Then it's considered now one can just go nicely on just having the morning and evening class and preaching. Like that. That's their system. So it works nicely. It works nicely. Results are there. Yes, sir. Charged means taxed.
Judged.
Judged. Oh. It question is the Manu Samhita applicable in this age? And does, what do you call it? Who is to be judged like that? So, who does the judging? Okay. So the Manu Samhita, Prabhupada mentions it, that the leaders, in the second chapter of Gita, that the leaders, those who have the nature to lead, then they should, you know the Dharma Shastras. He mentions, like Manu Samhita, he mentions three, Manu Samhita, Yajnavalka Samhita, and Parasara. That these three, out of all the Dharma Shastras, these three are considered to be our line. Most all of the rules, you know, applicable for the individual and just on the Varnashram, other than the king, well, even on the king, are mentioned in Prabhupada's books. Bhagavatam itself mentions. Narad Muni discusses it with Yudhishthir. You know, he goes through all the Varnas and Ashrams. And so those are all the main actual principal points that you'll find in Manu Samhita. Then, so it is applicable, but you have to know how to apply it. In other words, those who will do the judgment are the same ones who should apply it. Means, as we discussed before, those who can understand how to follow the rules and regulations themselves, then they can be trained how it applies to the society. And then from those who can apply it to the society, then you see from those who can actually administrate, who can manage. Then those persons are the ones that should judge. Them and then those, it means at least they should be the ones that are the main persons, you know, the hands-on dealing and all that. And then, otherwise, then those who can, can understand the overall, then they can also be involved in the judgment. Like that. But unless you understand the whole principles, then how one knows how to judge. Like that. In other words, judgment on the big level is done by the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. On the, you know, overall level. Then in your village, then you have your village leaders, and then there's generally, that's a cross-section of people. It's very interesting, the Vedic system. It works when you get down to the village level. Then it's works more on, there's representation by all the different kinds of people. And then they discuss themselves, come to a consensus. Then from so many villages, then each village has a leader, and then so many leaders, then there's a leader for them. 10 village heads, there's one village head of them. 10 of those, there's another one. However much is your size of your kingdom. Then ultimately it gets up to the lower level of the management that represents the kingdom. And then that representation is then presented to the king and the ministers. And then that's the end of democracy. Then at that point, then the leaders make the decision, and they, based on their training and experience, make the decision. They can't be pressurized. It means what they make the decision, that's the way it goes. Democracy ends at the lower council. And the higher council, that runs by the discussion of the Shastra. You know, feelings end at the lower council. And Shastra then is the standard for the upper court. And then those who actually do judgment have to be able to base it on scripture. Like that. It can't be feelings. It means you can run in feelings down on the family level or the village level. But if you want to do something overall, it has to be based on the Shastra. Problem was with Kali Raj is that he was a village man and he was trying to be a king. So then, therefore, there was a breach of Dharma. Because he didn't know Shastra, he's beating a cow. Right? Someone who knows Shastra doesn't beat the cow. But he didn't know Shastra and he's presenting himself as a king. So this is a major problem in, you know, modern society. then judgment of women, then it depends on the situation. It's always been given more lax. But if nothing else, if the character is that bad and it's a great disturbance, then they'll be asked to leave that place. There may not be much punishment, but the generally principle is it's very, things are very light, you know. Things are very light, you know, because generally the things that they're dealing with are very light also. You know, like someone passes stool on the road, you know, like that. Maybe they'll have to come back and clean it up, you know, things like that. Is that what you wanted, or? Okay. Is there anything else? Or? Yeah.
Mentioning the importance of being under an apostle and being the ashram, apart from other often the ashrams may not have an apostle, apart from that, they are being teacher. Now, if they have a tendency to want to have a more directive apostle on practical. What is the proper course of action? I know that normally if you want to take diksha from someone, you have to ask permission for the diksha guru. Then you go to the potential diksha guru and beg for his blessing and his guidance. Maharaj told me once that in our family, aside in the family, if one wishes to go to speak to the uncle, he doesn't need to ask permission to the father. Still, somehow to avoid the confusion, it seems appropriate to have a formal clarification of the situation. What is your view on the situation?
The question is on Grihastha may, you know, be living outside the temple. Only authority that they may have is a Diksha Guru. And then, but if they feel they need more direction or instruction than that, then how to increase that? So is this done? You know, it's the etiquette is that the Diksha Guru gives permission to take advantage of the instruction of Siksha Guru. So then, but then it's also been said, it's just like in a family, if you want to talk to the uncle, you don't have to go and ask the father, like this. So how does it work? Just in relationship to the siksha, means there's other aspects we can look at. The aspect of we have the authority of the GBC, what they say, guru, what they say, we have the scriptures, what Prabhupada's saying. So we have in many ways authority. Now, if it's a matter of personal dealings in that, then to understand this aspect of siksha, then one needs to know, how you say, a little bit more of the... In other words, first we have to understand what is the siksha. The siksha will be Prabhupada's instructions. Prabhupada is the siksha guru. Whereas the term is preeminent siksha guru. So that means that whoever is speaking, what they speak must be based on what Prabhupada says. If it's not, then they're not actually a proper siksha guru or can't give relevant instruction in ISKCON. And in other words, in ISKCON, a guru doesn't stand on his own. He stands on his ability to represent Prabhupada's instructions. He can't do that, he's not actually bona fide. So this concept is the guru gets upset, decides to leave ISKCON, so therefore all the disciples go with him. That doesn't come into question because everybody is actually the siksha disciples of Prabhupada. And that is being assisted by the present personalities. Pancharatrik Diksha, then they're the next in line after Prabhupada. like that, but the just standing on the pancharatrik without the instruction is not the full understanding of diksha. Diksha means divya gyan. So along with it, the person who gives divya gyan and gives the mantra is called the diksha guru. He's a siksha guru because he's giving divya gyan, but he along with that gives the mantra, so therefore he's called, of siksha gurus, he's known as diksha. Right? But the siksha still has to be based on what Prabhupada said. So there's no standing for anyone to go out and take everybody with them and start their own thing and say, yes, we're followers of Prabhupada. Like that. It doesn't really stand. There's no obligation, in other words. So now within this, having defined the siksha, so now, within this level of siksha, space of siksha, which is siksha and diksha, which is below Srila Prabhupada, there's two levels also. Those who are committed to you personally and those who are not. Right? So, means someone who's committed means that just like the diksha guru, that wherever you are, whatever the situation, that connection is there, and that commitment to give instruction, and that instruction must be followed, that is always there. So you may also have, besides the Diksha Guru, you may also have Siksha Gurus who are on that level, that they care for you on that same platform. So that for establishing that level, that must have the permission of the Diksha Guru. Because that is the platform that's called Sadguru. That relation then comes within that element of that eternal connection. Right? But for non-committed Siksha, you know, you just go ask some questions and then you go your way, they go theirs. You may follow, you may not follow. You know, they may think of you again or may not. Or it's temporary, like you're under the temple president. He cares for you there, you move to another temple. Unless a personal relationship has been established, then that they may never really think of you much again, or you may never think of them. So this temporary committed or not, you know, not really committed at all, that's a level below that. So for that, one doesn't require the permission of the spiritual master. That is the process, is that you take advantage of the local authorities, local devotees, and hear from them. But when it comes to the point of accepting their instruction as your life and soul, then that level of Siksha Guru must be approved by the Diksha Guru. Right? Does that make some sense? Because that two are there. So it's just like you may, you know, how you say, you're free to go and discuss with the uncle and this and that, but if the uncle's instructions then are going to be taken, and then how will that balance with the father's? So that means the uncle has to be careful in speaking, that it's always doesn't undermine the instruction of the fathers, unless the father has said that this person, I've taught you what I can teach, now you learn further from this person. Or you take this person's instructions like you do mine. Right? Then one takes on that level. Otherwise, one hears something that may be very deep and have great effect on our life, then that needs to be then referred back to the Diksha Guru to confirm it and to hear more about it, to apply it to our own position, our own life.
On a different level than
I'm not sure. Maybe. Huh? Yeah, Hridaya Chaitanya. Means the question is who does one consider to be the ultimate authority, since it seems that the Diksha Guru also may not be the ultimate, seeming. Or it seems that the Diksha is, because then one, that is made the main position, even if one has a Siksha Guru. So, as we mentioned, the Diksha Guru is a Siksha Guru. It's just that out of so many Siksha Gurus, you only receive mantra from one of them. So that's distinguished as the Diksha Guru. So his instructions must go back to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada is the ultimate authority. And then as the overall authority for ISKCON, then the GBC, like that. So it has to be in line with what Prabhupada says and what the GBC says. Then what the spiritual master is saying then has its position, its weight. Then in the case of, here we see Shyamananda was initiated by, Hridaya Pandit? Hridaya Chaitanya. And then he was sent to Vrindavan for studies there, because Jiva Goswami and that, where they were running their schools and education. Then it appears that he got, the understanding of his position as a maidservant of Krishna as opposed to a cowherd boy. So now, if we also notice in the story, Hridaya Chaitanya was not overly pleased with this because the etiquette had been broken. He was training him in one way, and without his permission, he had taken up a different training. So then he walked from, Bengal all the way to Vrindavan just to correct this breach of etiquette. But when he got there, then he found out that it was Radharani herself who had done this instruction. So then he felt it was, he was satisfied. But otherwise, it has to come back. It's just the etiquette. You can't have an invitation to live at the uncle's house without the permission of the father. You may go and talk with them and this and that, father won't say anything, but if you're going to move out of your father's house and move into your uncle's house, that requires some permission. So it's just a matter of the depth of how it will affect one. Then one worries about, then that aspect is there. Also, it depends upon how far the spiritual master can take. When it's felt that he has been able to train as much as one can, then he may turn one over to someone who can take one farther. Or who is in a better position to teach. Since Jiva Goswami and all that were running schools, therefore, it was natural to send Shyamananda, Narottam, and Srinivas there to get trained, because the facility is there. But still, the etiquette must be maintained.
I heard earlier that the Diksha Guru must be a pure devotee of the Lord.
Diksha Guru must be pure devotee.
Like a Mahabhagavata.
You have to use the same term. See, this is the problem. We go, sees Krishna face to face, Mahabhagavat, pure devotee, liberated, established, you know, able to give this knowledge to others, fixed in their devotional service, free from material contamination. Each one of those is a different level of you know, here, one is they say Mahabhagavat, they take has got to be Nitya Siddha, right? Pure devotee means from bhava on down, right? Prema means pure unalloyed devotee. Bhava is still pure devotee. Madhyama or Kanista is still pure devotee. Pure devotee means that you are engaged in the Lord's service and your conscious determination is to please the Lord. Right? Subconscious, there may be so many material desires and anomalies. But your conscious desire and effort is to please the Lord. That is pure devotee. Anyavilasita sunyam. Anyavilas ita. The ita means in pursuance of anyavilas. Right? Means pure unalloyed devotional service. Means, in other words, that activities are in pursuance of pure unalloyed devotional service is called pure devotional service. That's what that verse is saying. So pure devotee means someone who's purely motivated. Consciously. Unconsciously, maybe so many things. But consciously. Someone who can understand their own faults can understand this point. Someone who can understand their own faults will immediately plead, but no, they must be pure because they can't tell the difference. They can't tell the difference between, and they're not liberal, they're not broad-minded. Mahatma. Right? Duratma means closed, miserly. Mahatma means broad-minded. Right? Right? There's a bird. Bird is, there's a sage sitting there in the forest, meditating, he's been there a long time, not developing so much in his meditation. He's there, and then suddenly an arrow comes and hits a bird, and the bird falls on the ground, starts flapping around and goes around this little pile of grass and stuff like that, you know, going around three times like that, then it dies. Then it gets four arms like that and goes back to Vaikuntha. And it's going, what's going on here? You know, so he checks inside there, he finds a shaligram. Right? And then he, you know, brings up the point and, you know, that, you know, he understands it just by even unknowingly serving the Lord and one like this. Right? So one can argue so many things, but the Lord and the Nityasiddhas, they're very broad-minded. So anyone who's simply endeavoring, trying, even if it's not perfect, even if the heart is full of so many contaminations, but they're sincerely trying to do, that's called pure devotional service. And that can be of three kinds, kanistha, madhyamuttam. Right? Depending upon their understanding of the Shastra, their faith, their chanting of the holy name, like that. So this, it's very simple. So that's pure devotee. Liberated also means only on the platform of bhava, right? Right? It's just like you have a general in an army and you have a soldier, right? A general is a soldier. But now if you just call the general a soldier, will that be proper etiquette? Or will it be kindly, slightly considered a little, below standard? One will be decorum impaired by saying it in that way. Right? Yeah. So now, we would not be calling a Nitya Siddha liberated. That is his qualification for, you wouldn't say Rupa Goswami is qualified to be, you know, Guru of the Universe because he's liberated. No, he's qualified because he's a Nitya Siddha. Right? So liberated means the Brahma-Bhuta platform. Brahma-Bhuta doesn't mean you have love for Krishna. You don't have any attachment to the material world, but you haven't developed prema. That's what bhava means. You're detached from the material world, but not fully attached to Krishna. It's in the middle. So bhava-bhakti is different from prema-bhakti and sadhana-bhakti. They're three different categories. So liberated is referring to someone on that platform, right? Someone who has a taste for devotional service is a madhyama. That's ruchi. Someone who's fixed in devotional service, that's the lowest end of the madhyama. That's nishta. Right? So one has to understand is all these different terminologies mean different levels in the devotional process. So, of course, we're looking for the top. Then if you don't get that, you come down until you find something that you can, that means something that's available. Right? But these are the qualities one looks for. But one has to understand the process. Just to shoot off the mouth in an emotional state does not mean we know the philosophy. Like that. Is that we're arguing about, who can be a Diksha Guru, which is an aspect of, Sambandha and the basic principles of Abhideya, but if we don't know what Abhideya is, the process of devotional service, don't know what Prayojana is, we're a little weak in our argument. Because Prabhupada is giving so many ways that one can see and at different levels. Like that.
In a letter, Prabhupada mentions that a spiritual master must be on the level of Krishna.
Yeah, the spiritual master must be on the level of Krishna. Okay. So now, if we actually look in the Leela, who is that person who's on the level of Krishna? Is there somebody? Krishna is known as Asamurdva, right? No one is equal or no one is above. So that means then there's no gurus. So I'm just pointing it out. Is this means someone who is on the level means who is in the fire. Because Krishna mentions whatever is in connection with me, that is sat. And whatever is not, is not. Someone can be very moral and upstanding if they're not in connection with Krishna, it's not sat. So these aren't the actual considerations. The real consideration is who is in the fire of Krishna consciousness. In the fire of the understanding of Krishna consciousness, the determination is Krishna consciousness. Then what is on the level of Krishna? Because we'll always be 1/10,000. We're small. We're a drop, and Krishna is big. But Sat Chit Ananda, that's the point. The soul is Sat Chit Ananda, so it's not something special. I mean, it is something special, but it's not this all or nothing. See, that's what I mentioned before. It's all or nothing, because it's coming from the emotional platform. Only Prabhupada does that. That's right. But we have to understand what is Prabhupada's position. We've put Prabhupada actually in a low position. The devotees say only Prabhupada this and that. Why is Prabhupada special? Because he's their guru. To them, Prabhupada is just their Diksha Guru or their Siksha Guru at best. Right? But the point is Prabhupada, that he has done that for some people. But his position is unique, not because he happens to be the Diksha or Siksha Guru, the next one after Bhaktisiddhanta. He's the founder of Acharya. So the founder of Acharya, that is unique position. So we're putting Prabhupada here, but Prabhupada belongs here. So the problem comes is we're putting Prabhupada just in the position of just Guru, Sadguru. So then the present Gurus, they're coming right here, and then everybody's get bent out of shape, because Prabhupada actually belongs here. Then you see a significant difference. Right? So that's the thing. So we're not actually appreciating what Prabhupada's position is. Therefore, we can't have doubts that he doesn't know how to apply things for time, place, and circumstance. He doesn't know how to present the culture for those present in the modern situation. Modern situation, we're so proud of it, we think it's so unique. The Roman Empire fell apart because they were into illicit sex and drugs. Right? And you throw into it, okay, their aqueduct was lined with lead, so that led to some some minor problems. Like that. So, what's so special about today? All these things they've been around for quite a while. Right? I do believe it wasn't when Columbus went across to America that they figured out that then they invented sex or something, or nice dressing or anything. I mean, if you look back, you go back in the 1700s, 1800s, 1600s, they dressed a lot fancier than people dress now. Right? Blue jeans are work pants, right? There's a bunch of yahoos out in America. riding around on horses, herding cows, right? Then there's some guy out there, and he got stuck with a boat full of this heavy cloth and a bunch of rivets. Being a tailor, he took the cloth, made it into a pair of pants, you know, just what everybody wore, and riveted it together. He had no thread. Then he went out and tried to show it to people. No one was interested. And then one of these guys, you know, riding around out on the range, they saw it, says, wow, this looks great, tough, because they don't fall apart like the stitch stuff. So that started the Levi's jeans. And then from there it is expanded to be, you know, high fashion, right? Like that. And how do you become high fashion? You take them, you bleach them or wash them with rocks or, you know, stress them so much they get holes in them. You know, in other words, what that guy riding on the horse, when he'd throw them away, then you take it and wash them, and then that becomes high fashion. Okay, so now we can understand the culture now is not anything really special. You know, it just happens to be what's going on today. But because of the ego of the living entity, he thinks whatever he's doing is special. Right? Whatever happened in the past is old. Whatever happened in the future, we really know what's going on. Like that. Each generation thinks they're where it's at. And the next one is crazy. And the last one is, you know, old-fashioned. Like that. So the point is that we become very proud thinking Prabhupada's my guru, but we have to actually understand who Prabhupada is. Right? Like that. So it's very special. What he has come to give is why he's so special, is he can apply it to the modern situation. Lord Chaitanya said, my glories will be spread all over the world. Right? Bhaktivinoda Thakur foresaw it. Right? Encourage Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in this. He established the machineries that you could do this with. The preaching mission, the MATS, the organization. Then he asked his disciples to do that. Prabhupada took it and did it. It's not that others didn't try. Others tried, they couldn't do it. They took the instruction and the machinery of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. They could not apply it in the West. They could not implant it. Prabhupada took it and was able to implant it. Right? So he's very special. He has fulfilled the prophecy of Lord Chaitanya. Right? So that does put him in a unique position. Right? And as the founder Acharya of ISKCON, everyone following him for the next, you know, hundreds or thousands of generations, then they must follow his direction. So besides being the Siksha and Diksha Guru for some fortunate devotees, he is still the founder of Acharya, and for everyone else he's the founder of Acharya. So the only thing special about them, one is they got the personal association, but what they'll generally work on is they are initiated by Prabhupada, right? That's always the thing. Prabhupada's disciples, why are they Prabhupada's disciples? Because they were initiated by him. It means the Diksha side. But the Siksha side is open to everybody. Anyone who follows Prabhupada's instructions is a Siksha disciple of Prabhupada. If we take his instructions as our life and soul, then that's a direct connection. Right? So then that position is on that side is glorious, because in the etiquette we see the Pancharatrik line. But as far as on the Siksha line, then everybody's Prabhupada's disciple. Who accepts him. Right? Means Vishwanatha Narottam, there was 100 years difference between them. But he's the next in line as far as Siksha goes. Not Diksha. Siksha. Because he fully understood what Narottam said. So Siksha, you can have gap of time. Diksha, it has to go from one living person to the next. That's why the Siksha is superior.
So whatever level one's guru is, One should render absolute surrender and absolute faith in the spiritual master.
Okay. It means, whatever the position of the guru, do we have absolute surrender and absolute faith? First of all, we have to ask ourselves, am I absolutely surrendered and have absolute faith? Because if we had absolute faith, we'd be a pure unalloyed devotee. Because by the definition of faith, faith is in all these platforms, right?
I mean, goal, as a goal.
As a goal, okay. As a goal, yes, as a goal. Because the guru's goal is also the same. Does that make sense now?
Yeah. With the application of this goal.
Yeah. The point is that we also have to be very, very careful. Because we like to apply the principle of everybody else should correct themselves, and then naturally I will be elevated. You know? It means I've heard so many kids, they come, they have an idea, they'll come to Mayapur, the Gurukul, and it'll be full of Bengali boys, and all the Bengali boys will be saintly persons, you know, they'll always be just singing songs of Bhaktivinod Thakur, and just always doing nice service, and wonderful, and nice, and, you know, everything like that. And they'll be the only one that can be, you know, uncultured, unbehaved, and untrained. But because of this nice association, very quickly they'll also come to the same standard. Right? Everybody else, so they're shocked when they come and they find that, well, everybody else in the Gurukul came with the same idea. So you got a Gurukul full of people who have come here to learn something. Not that I'm the only one in the Gurukul that has to be trained. And I, you know, you have to give me some space and I make mistakes and I do wrong things. Everybody else must be perfect. So many boys I've heard come with that idea. Right? And we see that it's natural because they get that from the parents. So the adults think that I'm the only one that can have problems. Everybody else must be perfect. Right? How can he be a leader? He's not perfect. But the point is leader means leaders and followers go together. Right? Means just as there are qualifications for a guru, there are also qualifications for a disciple. Right? So means in Krishna Kshetra's book on the Pancharatra Pradeep, in the back, in the index, in the supplement, he gives what, you know, we like to quote the Hari Bhakti Vilas on what are the qualifications of the guru, but there he quotes what are the qualifications of a disciple. Right? And probably if we read them, then everybody might start having second thoughts of whether they're a good disciple. You know? So absolute surrender is like, I would guarantee if you went around and asked all the present gurus how many of out of all their disciples do they feel are really seriously, as much as possible, surrendered, and you'll say they have a few. They could probably count them. So out of the tens or hundreds of thousands, they only feel that a few are really surrendered and really serious. So when we say absolute surrender, then there's a possibility our what we're saying is also quite relative. Right? So now, how to bring that into the point where it is actually inspiring? Because we are attempting to please. And because it's being done for Krishna, therefore it's absolute. And the spiritual master is trying his best to try to please his spiritual master. Therefore, that's absolute. Then on this platform, the questions and answers and the service and all the shelter is absolute also. This is a unique principle of the devotional path. So if we understand that, then we don't find any problem in the present system. Right? We don't find any problem in the present system. The only thing that's missing in the present system is actually understanding the system and how it works and what it is. That's misunderstood. So the only thing really lacking is that, is the understanding. And the training that goes along with it. Right? The training to get that understanding and the training that one would go through who understands. Like that. Yes?
Maharaj, I was speaking to somebody from the Gaudiya Math, just, you know, in the tribals. He was Narayan Maharaj's disciple. And he was going on about Raganuga Bhakti.
He was going on about Raganuga Bhakti.
Yeah, and I couldn't really I couldn't really work out what he was saying. I think he was being very straightforward. But can you explain what the difference between Raganuga Bhakti is and what we're performing, Sadhana Bhakti? Because you were saying that from Sadhana Bhakti you can't get the result you need.
Yeah, I mean this is also a little knowledge is dangerous. You could all hear? He was asking he was speaking to one Gaudiya Math devotee. They were talking about Raganuga Bhakti. So what is this Raganuga and how is it different from the Sadhana Bhakti that we practice? So that just that they say Sadhana Bhakti can't give you means that they don't even understand Raganuga Bhakti. Because Raganuga is also within the realm of Sadhana Bhakti. It's Sadhana. Raganuga is the sadhana of those trying to attain the platform of rag. That's why it's called rag anuga, right? Like rup anuga means those who are following in the footsteps of rupa. So rag anuga means those who follow in the footsteps of those with rag or attachment to Krishna. So anuga means it is practice. It's sadhana. So that's the first problem. Is they can't tell the difference. But they don't, that's like saying my Mercedes is not a car. Oh, you're just driving a car, you're not going to get anywhere, but Mercedes, it's the same thing. But the difference is the platform of it's spontaneous. Prabhupada talks about it. There's according to the rules and regulations, and then there's spontaneous. But both are within sadhana, right? Difference is that one is you're following it because the rule says it, you must do it, right? And raganuga means you're following because you want to follow. You have a taste for it, right? Means, Prabhupada gives the example in Nectar Devotion. Someone goes to Mangalartik because it's the rule. You have to go to Mangalartik. They know it's good, the Brahma Muhurta, and that's the best time for spiritual advancement, all this blah, so their intelligence accepts it. So then they force their mind to get out of bed in the morning. Right? Then spontaneous is you want to go to the you want to go to the temple because you want to see Krishna. Right? This is the platform. So that's the main difference. And spontaneous, it means it's real. It's actually coming from the heart. So just because one knows a few stories about the gopis doesn't mean that you're automatically on Raganuga. Because they have to learn so many stories to keep their mind busy. But if we use the example of may my mind be spontaneously attracted to you, just like a young boy to a young girl. How much does it take to keep the mind busy all day for a young boy or young girl? Right? A look, a touch, a smell. That one thing can keep one busy for days, weeks, months. One. Right? Isn't it? They're in a group of people, and the boy looks over, and the girl looks, and they just see each other for a moment. For days, they'll be thinking about it. Right? So you only need one story. Prabhupada, Krishna is so nice, he did this. And you can just think about it again and again, because you have taste for it. But it's like you heard that, and now I got to hear the next one. That means we like hearing stories about Krishna. Right? But the point is it's not that depth of rag that they're talking about. Even they don't understand. And why is it you have to do it? You have to do it because why? The scriptures say and this and that. And so by definition, where does that put that? Yeah. No, not sadhana, but vaidhi. Why are they saying? Because according to Vishwanath in this book, then therefore you have to... But that's exactly what Vishwanath says in the book. Someone who does it because the Shastra says you have to do it, rather than by spontaneous attraction. That is Vaidhi Sadhana. Just like I was explaining yesterday, the Babajis. They say they're Paramahamsa, but they're following Vidhi as much or more than us. More than us. Much more than us. So So they're not actually understanding because they're not on that platform. Right? Just, I'll give an example. You have an 8-year-old kid and you can tell them about sex, right? And they can sit around and giggle and laugh and joke about it, but do they actually understand anything about it? They just know it's kind of funny. But when they hit 12 years old, then they understand. Right? Then it takes on a different thing. So Raganuga means you hit puberty. That's it. So they can come and tell anybody they like, new people, this, that, and tell them you got to do Raganuga. But this is perverted. You don't go up to 8-year-old kids and say, you know, hey, you know, where it's really at is not, you know, playing marbles. You know? And then the 12-year-olds, they talk too much and they like to talk to the young kids, and no discrimination will talk to anybody. Right? Then someone who's engaged, they're more mature. They won't talk to the little kids. And they'll kind of stay away from the 12-year-olds. But they still are totally full of themselves. You know, they'll only talk about those high-level stuff. But once they're married, then now they can talk to little kids at their level, 12-year-olds at their level. They can give advice to those who are engaged. So that is the position. You either hear from the crazy teenagers or those who are engaged who think they've attained the pinnacle of life, or we hear from the nice, mature, married women. So that's the choice. We hear from the acharyas or we hear from these people. Just they say, you can't attain from this. Why? Right. And the scriptures say this, scriptures say that. It's just a logical, a scriptural argument. So it's Vaidhi. So Vaidhi is not, I mean, Sada Raganuga is not platform, is not dealt with on that level. You know? Someone who only likes to hear stories about Krishna and won't touch any other stories actually is not very deep in this understanding. It's not. They think they are, because that's the way the Babaji's are. Oh, they'll only hear stories of Krishna, Radha and Krishna. Anything on Mahabharata, this, that, it's too low for them. Let's give an example. You have a mother. She'll only talk about and hear about and think about when she is with her kid. Right? She's so dedicated to a kid, has so much love for a kid, that she'll only think about this. If you come to her and tell her, oh, did you know that your kid did this and that in the school? Oh, I'm not interested. You know, that's lower. It's not when we're together. Right? Oh, today, you know, your kid was playing, they did this and that, and he won the game. Oh, I don't want to hear about this. I only hear about when we're together. What kind of mother is that? Is that a weird mother or not? Right? So now, the mother can see anything. She's happy to watch him play ball with the friends and do this and that. She's happy to hear about what they did at school or, you know, doing other things or like that. Because she has so much love for the kid, doesn't matter what the kid does, she's happy with it. That's those on the platform of Rag. And actually those on the platform of Raganuga. This is Krishna's doing that. Jayadeva is writing one of the highest literatures. He opens up with the Dasavatar Shloka. And in that, we have one of them. Keshava Drita Narahari Ruhi. Keshava has come as Nrisingadeva. He doesn't see Nrisingadeva. He sees Keshava has come as Nrisingadeva. Right? Like that. So it's a matter, if one actually has, then one sees it in there. Lalita's kunj at Radha Kund, right? Topmost place, Radha Kund. In there, one of the main kunjas is Lalita's kunj. And on the walls of Lalita's kunj are all Krishna's pastimes of killing the demons. So, Prabhupada mentions, he talks about it so many times as purports, you know, those who think they're advanced, and they can talk all they want. But the same books that talk about these things mention that at some point one must be conscious of what are the rules, and he must be conscious of understanding these rules and how it's favorable and what is favorable. Therefore, those things that are not favorable for raga nuga are generally, those rules only are given up. And those rules that are either, favorable, directly help develop attachment for Krishna, or support it, or are neutral, those are kept. So, the rules that are against, that we give up, are Dwarka Dhyanam, worship of Rukmini Devi, using mudras during worship, not purification and Purvanga, but actually when we offer the articles, wearing kusa grass rings, so, and doing nyas on ourselves, means installing the mantras on our own body. Anyone here does those things? Did Prabhupada introduce them into our movement, making the movement non-compatible for Raga Nuga Bhava? So it's already been, our rules and regulations are already the platform of Raga Nuga. Our process is already Raga Nuga. It's just that we are not on the platform of having the realization of Raga Nuga. Otherwise it's already set up in that way. So Prabhupada's so expert, he's already set it up that way. But because he didn't use all the fancy Sanskrit terms, and didn't overemphasize, like the Babaji's, reading of Radha and Krishna's pastimes, therefore it's thought, oh, there's no Raga Nuga. Right? That comes naturally. Just like you don't have to take little kids and stick them in a box with, carbolic, gas, and then to ripen them. They just ripen on their own. They come to puberty on their own. So either one can follow the process at an earlier stage, coming to that platform and practicing it during the Madhyama, or one can preach very nicely through the Madhyama, and one will come into that stage at Bhava. Both are recommended by Vishwanath. So it's Vishwanath's book that they're using to establish that, ISKCON is not proper. But at the same time, in the same book, he says, no, you can also follow that path. Right? You can Kanista perform as Vaidhi Sadhana, Madhyam perform as Raganuga Sadhana, and then perfect that in Bhava. Or you can do Vaidhi Sadhana through Kanista and Madhyam, and then Bhava, then you can establish the Raganuga. Right? The difference is the other thing, you'll go through the Raga Nuga like that and move into Prema. While the other one, you'll be doing it for a long time. So it doesn't really matter. So when someone's ready, then they'll be there. It's not discussed publicly, openly. You don't go out and talk about it. Right? There's a teenager and they go up to little kids and start talking about sex. What will every mature person in society think? So, whole point is according to the rules of Raga Nuga, because it is sadhana, so there are some rules, is one doesn't discuss these things openly. Only those who have this kind of understanding, then that will be discussed. So therefore, this is Lord Chaitanya's mood. Of course, unfortunately, in that particular mat, they don't really care about Lord Chaitanya's mood. They surpass Lord Chaitanya and go directly to Radha and Krishna. So when it comes down to between Radharani's opinion and Lord Chaitanya's opinion, they take Radharani's. At least they think they take Radharani's. And they don't understand the Sankirtan mission because it's secondary, it's external. Right? But they forget who is externally doing the Sankirtan mission. Right? Advaitacharya was present. He could have very easily delivered all the living entities, but he didn't. Why? Because according to his statement, then yeyatam ampapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham. Right? As you surrender, he reciprocates. No one's surrendering, he can't reciprocate. I mean, or whatever. He's not. There's nothing to reciprocate with. Therefore, he said, only if Lord Chaitanya comes. Why? Because here you have the Lord, who is Mukunda. Means Advaita Acharya can liberate. He is Mukunda. But no one is coming forward. While Lord Chaitanya, he is Mukunda. He can liberate. But he is also taking the mood of the devotee. And the devotee has no qualms in going up to somebody and telling about devotional service. So that the reason that the Sankirtan mission is going on is only because Krishna is in the mood of Radharani. Krishna in Krishna's mood does not do Sankirtan. You do a nice yajna, he shows up afterwards. Right? You do nice deity worship, then you get the he gives the benefit. You come to the platform of advanced stages of samadhi, and he appears in your heart. That's how he works. Right? But the devotee will go out and bring people in. Therefore, it's only because Lord Chaitanya is in the mood of Radharani. That's why the Sankirtan mission is manifest. Otherwise, it wouldn't be. So the Sankirtan mission is Radharani's mood. But unfortunately, that's considered, it's too external for some people. Does that make some sense? The internal moods are what he's tasting himself. But the point is one has to understand what we're dealing with. It may be the highest, but that doesn't... It's just like the university students may talk, well, quantum mechanics is where it's at in mathematics. And then they're chiding the little, you know, the third graders because they're learning arithmetic. Can the third grader now just start studying quantum mechanics? No, until they've gone through the whole process, you can't get to that. That's why Lord Chaitanya asked Rupa Goswami to describe the whole process. It means you get to Raganuga by practicing the Vaidhi properly. Right? First you hear, then you contemplate. Then you're able to value and deepen your understanding. So Raganuga basically means that the contemplation is there, and then it becomes more part of you. So it's the next natural stage. It's the next natural stage. But one should study the process so one knows that it's there. That's the point. One must know it's there. Because that's from there, then you have to go to bhava. Right? Raganuga is still within the realm of sadhana. Then you have to get to bhava, and then from bhava you have to get to prema. So one has to go up through these stages. So the complete process is there. So now, for an individual, then one may consider how much he's, depending upon the rules, how much he's actually starting to have an understanding, an dependence, or an attraction or affection for Krishna. But in broad general, one can't talk this way. It's not allowed. And that's the opinion of the acharyas. So one has to be very careful. We had something on this?
I had a couple of questions.
No, but on this topic, or?
Yeah. I think the other difference that Gaudiya Math has mentioned is that in terms of spiritual master, the spiritual master must be someone who has seen the spiritual world, otherwise that Raganuga won't develop.
Has seen, but one has to understand, means the spiritual master has to have seen the spiritual world, but you have to see what is seen. See, there is seen, tattvadarshi means that he sees through the shastra, like that. That is also has seen, right? It's saying, the Gita is saying, one who sees with equal vision, the cow, the Brahman, you know, the elephant, and the dog, the dog eater. That is all seeing. But that person that they're talking about is on the Brahma-Bhuta platform, the liberated platform. They still haven't come to that platform of necessarily directly seeing Krishna face to face. So shastra chakshus means you see through the eyes of scripture. So that means you study scripture, you follow it, and you perform your activity and see according to that. So that's also tattva-darshi. You know? I mean, of course, best is that one has seen Krishna directly face to face. But you can see Krishna directly face to face in the form of his instructions, his pastimes, the deity, so many ways. It's just a matter of what you're taking. His point is anything in connection with Krishna is Krishna. So it's just how broad-minded you want to be. So it's basically proper etiquette to use the broader forms of it, because Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used that. Means in there's an aspect called bhava sadhana, which is the sadhana of someone in the platform of bhava. But he takes the first three elements and applies them from someone just beginning devotional service. Because they actually start there and they mature in bhava. Right? We hear that we're a servant of Krishna. So we hear about that before we become a devotee. But that matures when we actually understand our eternal relationship with Krishna. But it starts from there. You know? Varna das. Then we learn how to adjust with that. It means we learn how to adjust that I'm servant of Krishna, detach yourself from the material nature and engage yourself in devotional service. That may mature when we apply our understanding of who we are in the eternal pastimes. Smarandas, we always try to remember Krishna in relationship to everything we do. But that may perfect itself when we're able to totally absorb ourselves in that service, you know, of thinking of our eternal relationship with Krishna. So that's how Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur saw it, and that is how Prabhupada took the example. It's there in the introduction to Upadeshamrita. So he's describing it in this way. Yes. Is on this? Oh, who wants it? Yours is on this? Oh, okay. If it's on this topic, then is that, we'll get back. So is it on the same topic?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the practice of Vaidya Bhakti, I mean, and in the practice of Sankirtan, the adoption of the dress of a devotee, all these things, is kind of related to Varnashram as well as to this question. That the actual practice of all of the habits, all of the pancharatric customs, all of these things, do these also help us? These actual practices, rather than the conscious, can they bring about the consciousness, and can they remind us not only of Krishna but of what our spiritual body is?
The practice of the sadhana bhakti and and the Vedic culture, you know, the question is whether that can remind us of this. One is it's always talking about it, specifically understanding it, that we get from the association of those who are advanced, who are in that. So Prabhupada is one such advanced person. So in his books, he's talking about these things. Point is whatever level you're at is what you're going to see out of his books. Just I'll give an example. You have parents. Well, let's see. Just like someone talks something, and they're with a friend and they're talking about something they know about and others don't know about. So they'll use language that they know what they're talking about. And it does mean something to the person who hears it who doesn't know what they're talking about. But if they know more and they're more intimate, they understand the hidden meanings of what's there, besides the external meanings. So the scriptures always have the direct meaning, indirect meaning, and the hidden meanings. So if one understands this, one can see, means it's, Jiva Goswami points out that the Bhagavatam, every syllable is talking about Radharani. But otherwise, as far as words go, like that, there's only one mention that gets close to her name. Right? So the whole thing is, and he takes and he translates the first shloka of the Bhagavatam, showing how Krishna will be born, and he'll leave his house, he'll go to Vrindavan, and he'll perform all his pastimes and kill Kamsa and do all this and that. That's all in the you know, Tene Brahma Hridaya Kavyadi Kavaye. He's taking that and breaking it up by the syllables. Because Sanskrit you can break in so many ways. You break in a different place, you have a different word. So one who knows this science, then he gets deeper meaning. So what Prabhupada's, what the Bhagavatam's talking, what Prabhupada's talking in his purports, one can see it from the platform of Vaidhi Sadhana, Raganuga Sadhana, Bhav Sadhana, or Prema. So one can see it on all those four levels. So depending upon your advancement, you will see it according to that level. So if someone says Prabhupada doesn't talk about it, it means they're not on that level, or they haven't read Prabhupada's books, or they don't know Prabhupada. They may be on that level, but they don't know Prabhupada. Or they're on that level, they haven't read Prabhupada's books. Or they're not on that level, and so reading it, they don't see it. The Prabhupada talks about all this stuff.
Like you were saying before, the emphasis that they generally put is on Krishna Leela, Rasa Leela, whereas perhaps more of an emphasis for ISKCON might be on Chaitanya Leela, and the performance of Sankirtan, all of these kinds of things.
Well, the Samkirtan is the Rasa Leela.
Yeah.
That's the point. His performance of Samkirtan is the Rasa Leela. So rather than just sit around and talk about Rasa Leela, why not be involved in it? You know? Right?
Yeah.
What's better, experiencing it or just talking about it? You know? So that's what's going on. We don't see it. Means the Nitya Siddhas, they see the Rasa Leela happening when a whole group of devotees get together and have big Sankirtan. That's what they see. We just see a bunch of devotees getting together. Right? But they see the Rasa dance. So it's just a matter of one's, you know, it means those who are on that platform can see the Lord Chaitanya's Leela going on.
Through continual practice of that, do we start to remember?
By continual practice, and if we're associating, means we're reading Prabhupada's books and understanding his position, then slowly, slowly, as we mature, then these things will also come from his books. And then we will come in contact with those people who can give us these things when we're at that level. Because the point is that point of one only gets into Bhava Bhakti anyway by the grace of somebody from either Krishna, the spiritual master, an eternal resident of the spiritual world. In any case, any one of them can bring you across from Madhyam to Uttam, or from Asakti to Bhava. Like that. It's not by our own sadhana we'll get there. By our own sadhana we can get up to the platform of Asakti. We can't get beyond that. So it's a misnomer saying, well, if I just practice like this, I'm going to get there. No, because they're going to have to take you across anyway. That's just the way it is. So even we can say, okay, there's no guru here that can do that for you. But does that mean Krishna or the whole of Vrindavan is empty now and there's no one to come and bring you across? Because it's said that at that point, then one can take up Raganuga. So that means one could have gotten through to the point of Asakti, you know, great attachment for Krishna. And then, when one is invited to cross, then one takes up the Raganuga. So that option is there. Point is, it says chanting the holy name is complete, means it's complete. So either all the nice ideal externals will be established. You know, we ourselves are, you know, born in a great Vaishnav family, and we from the very beginning have heard all about Krishna pastimes, our parents are pure devotees, we grow up in, you know, such wonderful transcendental loving exchanges. Then and our own feelings and understanding, then we go looking for a spiritual master, surrender unto him, then he being the great personality is, and benedicts us with, you know, with pure love for Krishna, and then all this thing goes like that, you know, we read about that, but are we in that position? So it may not be so ideal, but it doesn't mean that it's not all going to happen. It's just a matter, the holy name will take care of everything. Like that. The holy name is quite competent. So he can take care of us. But one must be aware of the process. being totally unaware of the process, definitely it's going to be harder. But as we're aware of the process, then the stages naturally develop. But it's a delicate point, because those who are not qualified, when they hear about it, they take it up over-enthusiastically, though they're not qualified to do it. This creates a problem. So therefore, it's kept hidden, so that those who are not qualified will take it up. And Krishna's in the heart, and he'll see that you come in contact. Because it's in Krishna's interest. Krishna wants you in the spiritual realm, you have to come to that point. So it's in Krishna's interest to get us to that point.
We do it through Chaitanya, because...
Yeah, we do it through Chaitanya. Because Krishna has taken the mood of Radharani, that means he's available. Krishna protects Radharani, you can't get to Radharani. It's only by his grace you can get her service. Right? So he comes in the mood of Radharani to bring us in. Then when we're qualified, then you can get the service of Radharani. By the grace of Krishna, one gets Guru. By the grace of Guru, one gets Krishna. So you get the service of the eternal associates is only by Krishna's grace. Then by their grace, you get Krishna's service. So if they make Radharani so cheap. But you have to get through Lord Chaitanya's blessings. On this?
Connecting what we were saying earlier on about culturally devotees' practices, maybe they don't wash their feet after taking prasad, or you know, such a clean cook, a housewife, different things like this. But you may also find that some devotees may bite their nails, they may have some moochy habits like this. But they may also have a very nice devotional attitude there. Their internal mood is very pure in that sense, but they have some external bad habits. So I was wondering, just connecting all those different things together.
Yeah, of course. The point is the principle is one is always broad-minded. It means one sees what good is going on, and these other things, they will go with time. By proper performance of devotional service, all bad habits will go away. That's not the problem. What I was talking about is where we're proud of them and fixed in them. You know, it's just like one of the principles of devotional service, nishta, being fixed. So we're fixed in our bad habits, and we're proud of them. And in fact, the whole world, if they're not following these bad habits, then they're fanatic. That, then you speak against it and show its position. Right? It means, in other words, Baladev makes the point is that from the beginning stages of Shraddha up to through bhava, that this is all considered devotional service. Like that. And then when you come to prema, then that's the perfection of that. Then you have attained pure and loyal devotional service. Right? Does that make sense? But while Vishwanath points out that sadhana is sadhana, bhava is bhava, and prema is prema, and at prema, that's where devotional service starts. Right? So we emphasize Baladev's point when that sincerity and that humility is there. But if pride is there, then we take Vishwanath's point, well listen, at prema, devotional service starts. Mataji, what was your?
Yes, previously you talked about yantras installed on the body.
Yantras, no, that was nyasas.
Huh?
Nyasa. Oh, question is on yantras installed in the body. As far as I know, generally yantras aren't installed. They're geometric designs that you draw, and then a particular deity is installed in that, and that's kept in the temple or in the home for, you know, various benefits, basically. Most of them are used, you know, for karmakanda kind of thing. Mainly, we only use the ones generally for protecting the temples and that. In the Shringa ones like that. But what I was talking about on the body, that's called nyasa. Where you take the syllables of a mantra, and then it's just like you see in the Bhagavatam, the Narayan Kavacha. So that was the syllables of the mantra installed frontwards and then backwards on the body. Like that. So that's Kavacha, but it's done in according to a process of nyas. So then on ourselves, generally, we don't do that. Oh, the purpose of the nyasa is just to purify the body, like that. The impersonalist use it to think that I have become one with the Lord, because then the mantra is on the body, and therefore they think of that oneness with the Lord. So that's generally why we avoid it, is it brings out either that impersonal or the Aishwarya mood, while those things that are specifically for that purpose, we generally avoid. Like that. Is that like that? It's another way of purifying. That's all. It's a mechanical way of purifying. But we generally rely more on the change the consciousness and then we become purified. Is that okay? Okay. The from what I've heard and why in the Gaudiya, the question was is that she's heard that in the Gaudiya Math they don't give the Brahma Gayatri, which is the first line of our Gayatris, to ladies. Because the Brahma Gayatri is Vedic. And so the Vedic Gayatri then is traditionally not given to the ladies. In the Vedic culture it wouldn't be given. Yeah, the Pancharatrika are all given. Means in our tradition, the holy name is given, and the Pancharatrika Gayatris are given. Like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur would give the Pancharatrika Gayatris. No, I think they all had before. We see Advaitacharya initiated his wife into, like that. I think he initiated, Lord Chaitanya's mother, and all these different things. So that's very common, because Pancharatrik doesn't depend upon that. Because that's basically just taking that you have a body, and one is still not on the platform of Pancharatra. I mean, on Brahma-Bhuta. So the Pancharatra is necessary. So then that can refer either to men or women, like that. But the Brahma Gayatri is the Vedic, so that drops down into her definitely considering who's men and women, because then marriage is there. Like that, so that aspect. It's just like, what is his name? Sukadeva Goswami is running by the girls taking their bath. They couldn't care less because he couldn't care less. Like that. But when Vyasadeva comes, then immediately they go to get their clothes and cover up because he distinguishes between. So when one comes to the platform of the Vedic culture, that distinction is very strongly made, like that. So then, in that case, then the Gayatri would be for the men and not the women. Its purpose is to bring one to the Brahma-Bhuta platform. That's all the farther the Brahma Gayatri goes in its normal, in its basic understanding. The Pancharatrika Gayatris are for the purpose of supporting the Kama Gayatri. The Kama Gayatri is the first expansion from the holy name. In other words, the pastimes of Vrindavan are described in the Kama Gayatri. And then that's supported by the Gopal mantra, which is like the seed of that. Then you have Guru and Gaur Gayatris and Mula mantras to get to the Kama Gayatri. So the Brahma Gayatri is specifically for bringing one to the Brahma-Bhuta platform, like that. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur didn't give it to his women because it was, he made the point it's in the mood of Purusha Bhav. So what it's for is cutting the Purusha mood, like that. So then in your traditional Indian families, the women don't have that mood so strongly. So then the Pancharatrika Gayatris and the chanting of the holy name will take care of everything very nicely. But I think Lord Prabhupada, when he went to the West, he saw that the women were, practically men, so they could get some benefit by chanting it. you know. But that's for that purpose. It's not for the purpose of worshipping the deity. The Pancharatra Gayatris are the ones for worshipping the deity. So some women will bring up that Prabhupada changed the thing, therefore you can change all the other rules. No, he added in the mantra that helps one get off the bodily platform. Like that. But the right to worship the deity, the Pancharatrik deity, does not come from receiving Brahma Gayatri. Someone with Brahma Gayatri cannot worship the deity in a Pancharatrik temple. They're not allowed. They can do Vedic sacrifice, they can do samskars. That's their right, but they can't worship the deity that's installed according to Pancharatra. Yeah, but we're worshipping on the home level, not the temple level, which requires the Pancharatric standard. Like that. So it's a different... In other words, one needs to understand the Vedic, the Pancharatric, and the Bhagavat vidhis and how they relate, then it's workable. But generally most devotees don't know that their Gayatris... One, they don't know what's a Gayatri and what's not. Out of all those, then out of seven mantras, only four of them are Gayatris, right? Three of them are like mula mantras. They're not because Gayatri is a chanda, it's a meter. It has to have 24 syllables in three groups of eight. Then it's Gayatri. So that's yeah. And it must have these qualifications. It has a meditation. It has all these things in it. So the three parts have three different purposes. That makes it a Gayatri. So the others aren't Gayatris. So that's the first thing that is not understood. Second, very few know that the first one is Vedic and the others are Pancharatrik. And then what are their purposes like that? So when one knows that, then one... can't use it. One can't use it. Misunderstand it. That's a plot.
I read in the same books that the Brahma Maharshi hardens the heart of women. So does one conclude that one should be not be anything?
No, because Prabhupada gave it. It's like means. Something that's soft will become hard. Something that's hard will become softer. So. Is that a good explanation? it's just so much difference in the culture that is there, especially if you go back to the 30s. You know, I mean, you can see the Bengali ladies today in good traditional families, and their gentleness is so strong. Then you take that back so many years, then they're not really necessary. You know? That's there. It's the main point is the Brahma guy. It's not a big deal. It's not an important thing. It's not even part of the. It's not how you say. It's given at we give it at the time of diksha because of the seriousness, but it's not a diksha mantra. It's a siksha mantra. This is actually not understood also. The person who gives upanayanam is the siksha guru. He doesn't become the diksha guru. The person who gives pancharatrik mantras, that is diksha guru. The other one is called upanayana. It means to bring near the guru. It means it's for the purpose of siksha. So the Siksha Guru gives Upanayana. The Diksha Guru gives the Pancharatrik. So they're actually different. It's a much lighter thing because it would be given to kids when they're 5 or 8 years old. You know, so how serious is a 5 or 8 year old? You know, not that serious. So we take this mantra to, you know, much more, many times more deeply, to more significance than it actually is. Pancharatrik mantras are. That's why Prabhupada says this. Mostly he talks about first birth and then dvija. But then sometimes he talks about dvija, third birth. Then he talks about the spiritual initiation. Or so many times he says real initiation. That means the Pancharatrik. Because in India, system would be the child is born, he grows up, he's got some basic training from the parents. Then he gets Upanayanam, or the Brahma Gayatri. and he studies under the teacher, then when he matures, then Prabhupada mentioned like when he's 12 or so, then he takes spiritual initiation, then he takes up the serious worship and all these other things. So that's third birth. So because you can only, one is, in a tradition, only men would get that. Two, you have to get that within this up latest by the 16th year. Then by the process of Pancharatra, one changes the body. And by changing the body, then that's new birth. Then, because of that new birth means of Twija, then one qualifies to get Dvija. Does that make any sense? When you get the higher one because of rebirth, then one is less than that age, plus it's a new body, so then that mantra can be given. And the only reason it was given was just to show, it was basically for preaching. It had no other purpose than that. Because as far as our service goes, it's not necessary. You know? In for developing or chanting the holy name, it's not that important. It was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura wanted to ensure that the common, you know, the uninformed opinions of the Indian masses did not commit offense against the devotees, the preachers, by considering that they were less than Brahmins. Therefore, as Vaishnavas, they're automatically Brahmins, so therefore then they got Brahmin. And the purpose was to wear the thread. Mantra was not the main issue. Like that. But it's just that when one has that, then one can perform the samskaras and all these things. Like that. So the thing was is they would wear the thread. Otherwise he could have given him a thread, but then they would say, well, what about the mantra? So then they have the mantra, so that's taken care of. Otherwise, previous to him, if devotees were born in Brahmin families like that, then they would go through Upanayanam, they would wear the thread. If they weren't, they weren't wearing the thread. You know? You look at pictures of Narottam like that, they're not wearing the Brahmin thread. Generally at that Paramahamsa they don't generally wear. Depends. But it means you can put it doesn't matter. Right? It means if one paints them with wearing threads is no problem because they are. Those are the topmost Brahmin. You know? Okay. So it's not a problem.
Some very elevated Vaishnavas who are very humble and refuse to accept higher social status like sannyas. Is it all right to address them with the highest respect and high titles, or is it better in order to not disrupt their mood to keep a low-key kind of attitude towards them?
You could hear? Devotees who are very advanced, but they take a very humble profile, so then is it proper to address them, though, by, you know, higher titles or higher, you know, respect or worship? Basically, it depends upon the position, our relationship, and what they're willing to accept. If they're not willing to accept it, then it's not worth using it. You know? And if they don't mind, then one could. See, point is the advanced, the bees means one, someone who is advanced and one is taking great benefit from, one should always be respectful. Then according to the position, that respect is given. You know? So it's just like, let us say, you know, like the rule is you offer obeisances when you see the spiritual master. Now if he's so humble, he'll offer them back. That doesn't mean we don't offer obeisances because, well, he'll offer us obeisances. Our duty is to offer our obeisances. And then what he does, that's his move. Okay. question was, is how do you take things? Yeah. Mataji says we covered it before. Were you here before?
I have been sometimes a little bit.
Oh, okay. The basic principle is that when you take something from outside, it has come through its own particular reasoning and develop contemplation and values. Right? It's already come through that. That's why someone can write a book, because they've had realizations based on their contemplation, on what they have seen and heard. So one can take that, but then one should try to find where it fits within our own culture. You know, if it's a simple thing like, you know, how you drive a car, that's one thing. But it actually comes into how you deal with people and interface with people. In other words, stuff that would be etiquette and culture. Then better to, one may become aware of certain rules, you know, detail, how you say, applications or principles by other literatures. But then one should try to find its origin in our own. Right? That's why the principle is that one may hear instructions from so many people, but if it's something that really affects our whole lifestyle, and that will be brought back to the diksha. Ooh, we don't wear shoes inside, sir. Shoes. Yeah. Means that one takes it back to the Diksha Guru to find out how to apply it in one's life. Right? That's the principle. So we take things from outside, we have to bring it back and see how it applies through Prabhupada's books and teachings and these things. Then the presentation takes on our own flavor. In other words, Yukta Vairagya means we use the material energy in Krishna's service. But Yukta Vairagya means that we don't take outside cultures. We have our own culture. If you have the complete culture, what do you need a lesser culture? If we have our own, then there's no need. It means everybody follows that. You know, any community, any nation, they prefer to have something done in their own way. They can take something from somewhere else, but they're still, you know. Does that make sense? Like, that you go to a restaurant in France. They may have preparations from Mexico, but still the atmosphere and how they deal in that will still be French. You know? So it's just you use that element. We may use cars and machineries and all these different things in the Lord's service, but we don't follow the culture of those people that use those things. We follow our own culture. Does that make sense?
In Manu Smriti, it is said that a Brahmana shouldn't teach unless asked. So would you kind of explain in general what does this mean, and especially how does it apply to those Brahmanas in this country who are acting as officials, like the lectures or the books?
Brahmana doesn't teach unless, how you say, asked. So, main principle is, if you tell somebody something that they don't want to, they're not interested to hear, they're not going to hear it anyway. Then the knowledge itself, because the knowledge is valuable, then it'll be wasted. It'll be an insult to the knowledge. Plus, then the person who is speaking it, they put in the energy and time, and it's not respected. Like that. So this means in like specific preaching, or, you know, where you actually directly talking to a specific person, like that. In other words, you don't volunteer information that's not been asked for, because otherwise they don't take it seriously anyway. They're already going in a different direction. Now, going out and means giving a lecture, that means it's something arranged and then people are coming. So who wants to hear comes, who doesn't come. When you're going out and doing preaching, where you're just going out to the people, that's more of an emergency thing. Just like somebody's in a dangerous position, then you'll go and say something or do something, even though it's not the normal situation that you would take care of. So people are not knowing about the Lord, they are not bringing their life in line with the Lord, so then it's a dangerous situation. So we let them know that that is proper. Then the next stages after that is they come forward, we take then one. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anything else?
It is a very wide and big question, but how can one discriminate between compromising for the preaching, for the purpose of preaching? Like, what is the limit that one shouldn't trespass?
Oh, so what is the limit on, you know, seeming compromise or adjusting time, place, and circumstance in preaching? Means details may be adjusted, principles are never lost. That's all. The principle can never be compromised. Detail is just like someone must take prashad, right? Whatever is offered must be, means whatever is eaten must be offered. So now, in details of that, one may sit on the floor. When, you know, people come and sit in a line, somebody serves it, you know, according to certain orders and rules, and other people sit there very nicely, take a little bit, eat with their right hand, don't talk for jalpa, like that. Afterwards, they'll wash their hands nicely, and, you know, all these different things like that. So now in preaching, we may see that those details may not always be able to be applied. But the principle that one must offer what one eats, that remains. So we'll see is whatever we cook, we offer, and then we'll feed people with that. And if they don't follow all the little details of culture and etiquette, that's not so important. The principle remains. The detail may be adjusted. Like that. Anything else?
Manusmriti is for Satyuga and
Parashara
Samhita is for Kali Yuga.
So Manusmriti is for Satyuga and Parashara is for Kali Yuga.
That applies more.
I never heard. This probably recommends Manu, Yajnavalkya, and Parashara. All of them. They all say the same thing. Whatever's in Manu, Prabhupada's already said in his books. You know? Because you have the two aspects. You have the three aspects. What the individual does, and what are his duties. How the individual relates with other individuals. And how you overall manage the whole kingdom. Right? So the first two are always set. You may have variations in application, you know, for the others. But the point is in Satyuga, they were all hamsas. You didn't require this. They all lived in hermitages. Only in Treta Yuga, then you find the big kings and kingdoms came up, you know. So, like that. So the Dharma Shastra becomes very evident from the Treta Yuga. But the point is it was only written down in the Kali Yuga by Vyasadeva, no? Isn't it? So if it was only meant for the Satyuga, why would he bother writing it down? You know? He's taken all the verses of the Puranas, which is something like 4 billion, and reduced it down to 400,000. Right? He's taken all the what do you call it? He's taken all the what do you call it? Taken all the Vedas and then broken them up according to their parts. All the hymns in the Rig, all the prose in the Yajur, all the songs in the Sama, and all the miscellaneous in the Atharva. And then broken up the Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishads. So it makes it very clear so someone can be... So that's all done for the Kali Yuga. So also the compilation of the Smritis has also been done for the Kali Yuga. Why at the end of Dwarapara, why in the Kali Yuga, beginning of Kali Yuga, would you compile a book that's not meant for the people of Kali Yuga, only for the Satyuga? He could have just not compiled it. Right? I mean, he already left. He only took 1/10 of the Puranic stories. You know? So then why would he take more than is necessary? See, if we just take the particular applications of punishment, and that's it. But that's not what Prabhupada's really talking about. The culture is found in what the individual does and how he relates with others. That's the main thing. Then, for the performance of the king's duties, then they must also be able to understand what is proper judgment and how to settle disputes. Because in the material world, people don't cooperate as well as they should. So disputes arise. Therefore, the king has to know how to deal with that. So that's the purpose of those. So those may be able to be adjusted. The principle has to remain, right? But the aspects of just application may be adjusted. You understand? So you have to know what is the purpose behind the rules, like that. It's not enough just to know the rule. It means Manu speaks first and makes it very clear that Krishna has created the creation, then he creates Brahma, then all the elements of the universe are manifest, and Krishna enters into everything and makes everything alive. Once he's done that, then Brahma, through Brahma, Krishna is creating all the planetary systems, the living entities, rivers, everything like this, and then he creates the humans, and then he creates what is right and wrong. Right? In other words, the process of what's right and wrong comes from Krishna. He's established it. He's created everything. Then he hands it over to Bhrigu to speak. And then Bhrigu speaks. And he gives all the rules and regulations. Right? So now you have to be able to take each one of those rules through that process. Otherwise, if one isn't really well read. Right? The Manasamhita also mentions that those who have brahminical nature, they should teach it only. Yeah. They should teach it. Others shouldn't teach. So one has to be very careful. Otherwise, then one will put one's own interpretation into it. So the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, they would normally read this. But as far as teaching it goes, then that's the Brahmins doing. Like that. Individuals apply it in their own life. Kings see that everybody's applying it properly in their life. And the Brahmins teach and train and give advice to the others.
Are divided into three groups, the six Satrikas and six Brahmas and the Brahmas. Do we have a similar division of the 108 Upanishads?
No, the Upanishads are the you hear? The Upanishads, it means the Puranas are divided into the three categories of Tamasic, Rajasic and Sattvic, so the Upanishads divided like that. Just by definition, no. Upanishads are meant for those who are interested in Brahman. Like that. So, generally the Brahmachari would study the Samhita of the Veda. Means all the verses. Then as a Grihastha, he would practice the Brahmanas. Means the rituals. Then as a Vanaprastha, then he would learn the hidden meanings behind the rituals. Right now that his passions are gone and he's done, now he can get into the esoteric meanings behind the rituals. Then is the sannyas, then the concentration is on the Upanishads. Right? So there's no question of the three modes. The Puranas are written that they themselves are not in the three modes. They're written for the audience of the three modes. Right? In every Vedic book, then they tell who is the audience and what is the qualification of one to study that book. Right? And then what the purposes of the book and what you'll gain from studying the book. Right? So they'll put the sambandhabhideya prayojana of the book and who's qualified to learn it. Right? So you write for an audience. Just like a children's book, let's say I write a science book for young children, right? Now, are the facts and figures in that book not true, or are they still true? True, okay. But are they written, is it written for adults, or is it written for children? Okay. So that means an adult would not be overly satisfied in reading that book, right? Okay. So that is the meaning of the Puranas in these three modes. Is the Tamasic are written for an audience who is in the mode of ignorance. What it says in there is not wrong. It's just written from the angle of what someone in the mode of ignorance would want to hear about. Ones in the mode of passion are written from the angle that taking those stories that someone in the mode of passion wants to hear about. And goodness, they're written for someone in goodness, what they want to hear about. And then Bhagavatam is written for the Paramahamsas, transcendental. So the book itself is not in the mode of ignorance. The people who like to read it are. It's written for them. That's all.
Then what does the words of Lord Krishna Gita mean? He says, Trigunya Vishaya Veda. What does it mean?
Trigunya Vishaya Veda means the Vedas are written because they deal with how to engage the three modes of nature. And they're generally not, it means, if you just take externally what the Vedas say much of the time, then it is seen that it's written in such a way that someone could absorb themselves in the karmakanda. Like that. But their actual purpose is always remember Krishna, never forget. But the tendency of the living entity is to forget this point. You know, he doesn't remember this point. So that's why, I mean, Krishna points that out, is that one should be careful of these because it's written for people who are under the influence of the modes. The Veda is called aparavidya, that it's material knowledge that's in connection with the Lord. Right? Vedanta, that is transcendental knowledge. You know, the Bhagavatam, the Gita, this is paravidya. The Vedas, the Sanskrit, astrology, Dharma Shastras, this is all aparavidya. Material knowledge that's in connection with the Lord. Right? Now, if you connect it with the Lord, it's called aparavidya. It elevates you. If you don't connect to the Lord, it's called avidya, and it takes you away. Right? That's why at the beginning of every Vedic book of knowledge, it always first gives the whole creation and everything and brings it down to the point where that knowledge then comes into play. Right? So one may wonder why all that's done. Like, you know, Brahma gives all that, then after that, then Bhrigu then starts talking about all the different species of life, and then he starts talking about time, and you're thinking, well, what has that got to do with Dharma? But karma is time mixed with the modes. Time is movement. And if I move under the influence of the modes, that's karma. And if I move and there is no influence in the mode, there's no karma. Right? That's why Nishkam Karma Yoga creates no fruit, no reaction. Because I'm moving, but for the purpose of pleasing Krishna. So there's no reaction. There is no karma. So first he describes what is time, and then what are the reactions of the karma. When that's understood, now we can deal actually with understanding the four varnas and ashrams. Because we understand that these are just, if you move and then you want this fruit, this is what you're going to get. Right? But now if you move doing these without wanting that fruit, then it elevates you. You understand? Yeah. So that's the whole point. Is you can either follow the Varnashram system to help you go back to Godhead. You can follow the Varnashram system to go to the heavenly planets. You can neglect the Varnashram system and become degraded like that. These are the options. So Krishna is recommending the quick path, means do it for Krishna. Then in one lifetime, then one can finish up the whole path. Otherwise, if you go the slow path, then you do it just for... Then you have to go for millions of lifetimes to karma, then you may come to the platform of jnana, millions of lifetimes of that, you may come to the platform of yoga, so many lifetimes of that, maybe you'll become a devotee. Then once you've gone through all that, then you take up devotional service. So you might as well just start from that at the beginning and cut out the whole thing. And just start from the beginning doing your duties for Krishna. That makes sense?
I mean, on the one point, even Bhagavatam belongs to Sattvika Puranas. It's interesting how can other people who are, for example, on the level of Rajas or Tamas, how can they understand Bhagavatam when we distribute it to them?
Oh. Means if someone's on the platform of Rajas and Tamas, how they'll understand Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is pure, and by coming in contact with it, they become purified. So the transcendental knowledge is independent. It doesn't require qualification as such to work. Just like the holy name, it will purify you whether you're qualified or not. A Gayatri mantra, unless you have brahminical qualifications, you won't get so much benefit out of it. So until there's some purity, you can chant the Gayatri mantras and you'll get no benefit out of them. They're not independent. The holy name is. So the transcendental literature, it can purify someone even though they're unqualified. Well, the other literatures, if you're qualified, then you can become purified by them. Like Sanskrit, you're qualified, then you can learn Sanskrit and actually engage in Krishna's service. You're not qualified, you'll learn Sanskrit and it'll take you away from devotional service. You understand? Like that, because it's a material knowledge. But the transcendental knowledge, then it can purify. And it will then bring one in contact with the proper, you know. Then Krishnas Kaviraj Goswami mentions in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that one who is his how do you say, yeah. That when we're interested in devotional service, then we come in contact with the bona fide devotees, the bona fide sampradaya. Otherwise, then one doesn't. So the Lord of the Heart is also there. He is part of the process. We can't leave him out of the scene. That makes sense.
Just on Dhanashram again. You've been talking about internal and external, like the internal realization of Brahman or Sannyas, and the external performance of one's duties according to the bodily conditioned nature. When it's said that a Vaishnava is beyond Varnashram, does that only refer to that internal realization, or does it also can it also apply to the performance of duty and the purification of the bodily conditioned qualities? I was kind of wondering specifically in the context of temple life, where that is often used as a reason for devotees doing all kinds of duties. And all kinds of
yeah. Are you all here? Then the question is that, you know, what is meant in where the devotee, in the context of, you know, devotee is automatically a Brahman, and Nishkam Karma Yoga means that one is acting on the platform of sannyas, whatever the Varna Ashram one's following. And then the point is the point of devotee being, Vaishnava being transcendental to the rules of Varna Ashram. So then how does that apply in just devotees doing any kind of service, this, that? So basic principle is that the Vaishnava is beyond the Varnashram, because technically Vaishnava means is that they're beyond the platform of Brahma Bhuta. So once one comes to that platform, the conditioned nature doesn't exist anymore. But the devotee for preaching, who is on that platform, will act as a madhyama and follow the rules and regulations. It's like Krishna, he's beyond everything. Means we have the tendency to think, well, there's the material world and then there's the spiritual world, which includes God. But actually, God is beyond the spiritual world. He created it, so he's something else. It means there's the material world, there's the spiritual world, and the spiritual living entities. And then there's God. God is something else. So God himself comes to the material world and he follows the rules and regulations. So it's just for, he does it to set example. So for someone on that platform, then they must follow it. For someone, the madhyama, the externals aren't as important. It gives a body in which to, you know, work with others, but the internal meanings of things and seeing through the eyes of the shastra, that becomes the important thing. In other words, the jnana part of the nishkam karma yoga becomes the prominent feature rather than the karma part, like that. So then devotees are transcendental, meaning that means in general is that the material mundane considerations and values of those specific varnas and ashrams aren't the motivating factors generally behind the devotee's practices. But you still must know the nature of the individuals. You still must be able to understand that if the service that the devotee is doing is suited for his nature. And if so, that's fine. And if not, then you can only temporarily run them in that. And if you just go on chanting this magic mantra, Vaishnavas are transcendental, then when they bloop, then one will have to reconsider one's application of this mantra. Like that. Because the point is devotees are transcendental, but we're talking two different levels here. It means when we say Vaishnav, strictly we mean the Uttamadhikari, like that. But even we take it in general use, then that means is that the motives of those varnas and ashrams aren't the prominent driving features, Krishna consciousness. And then to engage their conditioned nature, they take those activities. Because it matches their realization. Does that make some sense?
Yeah. I was wondering how long you can continue working against one's material nature in a temple with 5-10 people in it. How can Varnashram ever operate?
No, you can operate. It's just Varnashram be operated on a small scale. It means everybody who's there just acts according to their nature.
If everybody's Kshatriya by nature who happens to come to a temple, or everybody's...
You won't find that. Kshatriyas are very rare.
Well, if nobody's like a Kshatriya and everyone's a Shudra that comes to a temple,
then they should set up a Namhata.
Okay.
Like that. The temple, the life in that should specifically be geared to Brahminical lifestyle. Though someone who's expert in management, you know, have a Kshatriya nature, they can organize the whole thing and see that it runs nicely. You know, those with Vaishya nature can deal with, you know, the funding and, you know, especially short-term works, important works, like dealings with, let's say, some government official or setting up something, getting permissions or organizing a festival, like that they can do. Long-term, it's very hard. Long-term, it's hard for Vaishya to do the same thing day in and day out unless it's getting profit. They can do business day in and day out because at the end of the day, there's something happening. But the other things is, it's very hard for long-term. So they're very good at expert short-term things that require intelligence. They're good at that. You know? But the Kshatriyas and the Brahmins can do things for a very long time. Means everybody can do long time if it's in their field. Big management, long-term management, that can be done by the Kshatriyas. You know, the study and teaching can be done by the Brahmins. Like that. So that's why everybody sticks to their own thing. Then they can do it for a long time. Otherwise, then they can do it for a short time if it's needed, but then they have to slap back into their place. Otherwise, they become frustrated. So if that was understood, the temple leaders then could organize devotees according to their nature, and then so much could be done. Same time, there has to be training, because the nature has to be purified. Someone may be expert manager, but if he's proud, it'll be a problem. So you have to train and remove that pride. Then you're just left with the management ability. You know, it's not an efficient system that the person has. Is proud and is a manager, so you remove him from management. No, his nature is managing, so he's going to become purified by doing management. But the situation has to be such that he's becoming purified by that, so that these anarthas are going away. One of the modern things, you just remove them. But you see what happens. You have a revolution, the bourgeois goes to the mass. Then they kill all the royalty, right? And many times all the intellectuals, because intellectuals know unless you have a hierarchy, it's not going to work. So you kill all of those ones, except for the more, you know, free-minded anarchist ones. Then all you're left with is a few wild, you know, Brahmins and, you know, very, how you say, motivated, you know, bourgeois. Now the bourgeois can't work for the people's interest, because their original thing was that they had a problem. The people were generally doing fine, right? Otherwise, if they were actually worried about the people, they wouldn't have used that method. They would have worked as a king, one king to another king, challenging. You are not managing your kingdom, people are dissatisfied, therefore I challenge you and I'll defeat you, and then I will run your kingdom properly. That's the only reason a king will fight with another king. Is because his people are not being... Either the other is a threat to protection of his own citizens, or the citizens in the next kingdom are dissatisfied and they're coming to him for help. So he must extend protection, if he has the ability. But if they just go to the mass, get them all riled up, you know, kill everybody there, because why would you bother killing all those people? Right? You know, the problem is just the people that are making the problem. Right? You go to Russia, who's making the problem? They didn't like the Tsar, it's the Tsar. But they have to kill everybody. You know? Tsar's son may have been a very nice leader. So until they check, how do they know? And they just wipe out all the royalty, they wipe out all these, you know, all those who can do that. They wipe out anybody intellectual is not into it, and they wipe out all the Vaishyas. And then what do you have? Place is a little wild. You know, economically can't function. People can't even get enough to eat. What they do grow to eat, they can only grow cabbages and potatoes. You know, so it definitely, it's not the superior system. Right? So if there is a problem, if we use that to remove people, then that's not a good thing. So the point is if the manager is not pure enough, you have to have a system to purify them, because they're means of purification is going to be management. Krishna says, work according to your nature for him. So if someone has managerial abilities, he has to manage to purify himself. We see Prabhupada would do that again and again. Someone was in a management position, they would fall down. When they come back to the movement, he put them right back in the same position. Because that is the position how they're going to purify themselves. So one has to see, but that doesn't mean that there's not monitoring in some system to see that they're coming up to the standard. That's the business of the leaders in the society to do. Does that make sense? So just like the followers, you have to know what is their nature. The leaders, you also have to know what their nature is. And then everybody should be engaged accordingly. So if in that situation is going to be bad, you put them in another position of management where they're going to not bother people. But they still have to manage. You know? Unless it's too outrageous, then you work out something else. Let them go do something, you know. Go on padayatra, do something, you know, purify themselves, get more of a focus on things, and then come back and continue in management. But just to just remove them means a misunderstanding of Varnashram. It's common. I mean, it goes on. Every history book talks about it. The bourgeois jump up and down, and then they throw out everybody above them. goes on. It's one has a choice. One either deals according to Krishna's system, and that way then the modes work in the proper way, or one is controlled by the modes, and one works in all these other ways. I mean, that's the choice, basically. So devotees have that choice. Through the culture, then they get things done, or they can just be carried away by the modes and do the same exact thing that the karmis have done for thousands of years and never gotten a good result. Never gotten a good result. Yeah. Chapter 2. So the question is that can someone lose their status? Let's say they have a nature, the training, and that of a Brahmin, can they lose that? And can they also regain it? Yes, when they lose it or can't gain it in the first place, that's the question is that can someone lose their status? Let's say they have a nature, the training, and that of a Brahmin, can they lose that? And can they also regain it? Yes, when they lose it or can't gain it in the first place, that's called Dvijabandhu. Means friend of a Brahmin. Or Brahma Bandhu is friend of a Brahmin, Dvija Bandhu means friend of the Dvijas. They're from the higher nature, but they can't come up to the standard. So then they generally work within the realm like just the artists. You know? And one can always regain it. It means that if one had the nature, just like we see Ajamil, he was duly trained as a very nice Pakka Brahmin. And then he lost that status. You know, he was acting as, you know, sixth class man, you know, stealing and all this kind of stuff. But then, by the grace of the Vishnu Dutas, then again he regained that position. And he took up very seriously practicing the you know, devotional and brahminical culture. So it can be. But we see that one gains by association, and generally one loses by association. So he lost by bad association, and he regained it by good association. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe here. Okay. We're getting late. What?
Can there be mixed varnas during the purifications? At least here in the beginning, it seems to be that there are, you know, like mixed.
In the beginning, yeah, means as one becomes purified, when one sees that that goes up through that. Means generally, if it's more clear, then you can have mixes. Means because when you mix the two, then you end up with something, but not necessarily the. I'm not as well as I can't give you examples of it, but it's not necessarily if you meet a Brahmin, mix a Brahmin and a Kshatriya, that you end up with a very sattvic Kshatriya or a very, you know, management inclined Brahmin. You may end up with something else. You know? Just like when you mix two chemicals together, sometimes what you end up is with a third item. You know, it doesn't end up as the same. So then that considerations are there. But I can't give examples. Then the other thing is that a quarter of your nature is by who you associate with. So if you've kept very bad association, you will naturally reflect that association that one's had. That will be there. So if you change that association, then that will also change, to some degree, one's nature. You know? At least bring out the best in it. Like that. Because if one is predominantly in the mode of ignorance, let's say one's been association with a lot of, you know, uncultured people, or one's been into drugs or stuff, automatically that's going to increase the mode of ignorance. So then one's going to act more like a Shudra. Then as one gives that up, then that ignorance will get less, and then the modes of passion or goodness will start to become manifest, depending upon what is the nature. You know, so that will, in other words, especially sinful life. Pious life will bring out the nature. Sinful life will cover the nature. Okay.
I was wondering, there are so many books now, different books written by different spiritual masters and different devotees, and I'm a former disciple of Hare Krishna, and he used to say to us that we should first read our past books, all yeah. books, three times. Is there some, what would you recommend to be a...
Standard. Means question is on reading Prabhupada's books or reading other books, what's the important? The balance is, the GBC may brought up that point, is that best to study very nicely Prabhupada's books, and then from there one can expand out into these other things like that. Or in any case, the study of Prabhupada's books should be the predominant study. You know, means other books should be mean just be as supplement. And they must be seen in light of what Prabhupada says.
So there is no one, it's like they leave it in
the it is. It's always recommended that one emphasizes on Prabhupada's books. That's the best standard. Prabhupada says that one should read all his books. If he doesn't read all his books, then one can fall away.
Because one can see that often, you know, one has spiritual master, he has written some books, and then
you want to read. Yeah, so those can be read. Those can be read, but it shouldn't be in exclusion of Prabhupada's books. It means those can be read, but the main thrust of study must be on Prabhupada's books. Yeah. And whatever is written in those books must be seen in light of Prabhupada's books. You have to interpret him through Prabhupada's books. That's the I think the fifth principle of sadhana bhakti in the sixth chapter of Nectar of Devotion, is that approaching the previous acharyas through one's own acharya, like that. So the principle is that Prabhupada's written the books; he's our acharya. So anything that's comes before him must be seen in light with his. So that also that continues means. Anything that's after him also must be seen in light of his. Does that make sense? So much. Okay. So I think we should end here, starting after 2. Thank you very much. That's one last question.
So those devotees
what is their connection to the previous acharya? Means if they're from other sampradayas, they have their line and they have their goal. And like the Madhvas are interested in Swarupya, you know, like this, you know, so they have their goal.
And if they are from
means if they joined the Gaudiya Math temple originally, then they have their line. It's basically the same line. It's just the Prabhupada points out is what makes the Gaudiya Math asar useless is that they didn't establish a GBC. So because of not doing that, they tried to establish a world acharya, and that fell apart. They couldn't manage that, so they sent up temple acharyas. So each temple has its own acharya. Only he can initiate. So. they work with their god brothers to the point where they become more senior, and then they go off and open their own temples. So in other words, the preaching machinery is programmed to fall apart. You know, you have one mat, one acharya, he has five god brothers. They all work very dynamically to preach, and then that goes on nicely for some years. Then when those other five god brothers become senior and people want to take initiation from them, those five have to go out and open their own temples. So now they no longer work. So that one man is left sitting alone, and now they're left sitting alone. So it's not a madhyama system of cooperating, working together. It's actually a kanista system, because kanista system is me, my guru, and God, us. So that is why Prabhupada calls it asar, useless, because it looks dynamic today, you come back tomorrow. I mean, you read in the Lilamrita, what was the Devananda Gaudiya Math at the time when Prabhupada was there? 20 sannyasis there, preaching, dynamic, vibrant, everybody wearing the nice same color and dancing together, and they were the most dynamic preaching mat. You go there today, that's not there. One man sitting there. You know what I'm saying? Connection is not broken spiritually. What I'm just saying is, this problem makes that point is because it's not. Sankirtan mission is supposed to be dynamic. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, establish a GBC. They established a GBC. Then after a few years, some say two, some say eight, then they rejected the GBC because they said it was too slow. You know, we had to come together, we have to discuss. Much easier if you just have one man make all the decisions. So they established a world acharya. That's when they deviated. Like that. That's when the whole thing fell apart. And then from there, just then when he didn't work, then whoever supported him grabbed those mats. Those that have different ideas grabbed other mats, so then the whole thing split. And then those who didn't want to get involved in the politics opened their own mats. And then their disciples, then they have to split and open their own mats. So you go from, you know, you go from up here, the Chaitanya mat, down to the Ghat down here, you probably have about 20 different Gaudiya mats. And they're not cooperating. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's appearance day, they'll come together. Other than that, they're not preaching dynamically together. You know? So that system, they lost it from there. But as far as the philosophy, it's the same. They follow it, you chant Hare Krishna, follow it, you go back to Godhead. But if they've joined from here and they leave to go there, then that's not so good. Because those men didn't go out and collect them. By Prabhupada's influence, they were picked up. No one went out directly to them and got them. Now a few go out. But most of them just go to our already established ISKCON communities. They don't go out on their own to a place out in the middle of nowhere. And even if you say, okay, some of their disciples are, generally they're all from Prabhupada's mission. You don't have Bengali boys from the village here going out there and sitting down in some place and starting up a new mission. In other words, Prabhupada's machinery they're using, you know, which we're not complaining about. But the point is that if Prabhupada's picked one up, then one should stay within that line. That's Bhakti Vinod's point. He makes that point. Is that one should take initiation in the line of the founder. That cooperative spirit.
Yeah.
Means just someone goes on their own and that's it. It'll be more difficult. If it's like the facilities are how you find you have to conduct the grihastha life and you end up out in the middle of nowhere and that's all you can do, that's one thing. That's not a problem. But if it's a matter of you go off on your own because you can't tolerate working with other people, then it'll be a big obstacle, because in the spiritual realm you got to work with a lot of people. You have to cooperate with a lot of people. Right? It's not going to be just us and Krishna. Like that. So the one practices here how to cooperate. The rasa dance happens because there's no cooperation. No, rasa dance happens because there's a lot of cooperation, a lot of management. That's big time management to organize a rasa dance. Right? Somebody didn't just wiggle their nose or something and it happened. You know, it was managed. You know? So that means they had to cooperate. But because of their love for Krishna, they all naturally cooperate. It all happens very easily. So it happens so easily, it doesn't look like management. That makes sense? Are you satisfied with that? Or? Okay, so we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki.